Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. Huh. And I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you Christmas contraband and ancient tales.
All right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m., as I am every weekday morning, Monday through Friday. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran has your morning drive at 6. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because he does that every Monday. My dad will call in, tell a joke, because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Also Monday, that means it's Monday morning movie review time. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me every Monday to talk about the new movies, and we will do that. And also, Eric will stick around and tell us all about the box office results as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show, and stay connected on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Nick D Show. Also, download our podcast. Subscribe to our podcast. Lots and lots of people listen via podcast, and we appreciate that. Thank you very much. But it's easy. Subscribe. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen online. You can listen streaming. All that cool stuff. All kinds of devices that we can. You can hear us do the show here on WGN. Also coming up, the Toy Hall of Fame has announced their finalists for this year to join the Hall of Fame, and we're going to talk about that and talk about some of the best toys ever and what were your favorite toys when you were growing up. Joe Maddon has left the Cubs. It was his final game, and so we're going to talk about that and about some of the other Cub managers of the past. And there's a lot more going on this morning. We want you to be a part of it at any time. If you want to talk, text. It's 312-981-7200. Okay, let me say hello to my great producer, Tom Hush. Tom, how are you?
I'm great, Nick. How are you?
All right. How was your weekend?
It was very good. It was really a lot of fun.
So you went to the Music Box.
Yes.
Saturday night at midnight to see John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness.
Yep, and it was just as great as I would have ever expected.
Yeah.
Got to see it on the big screen.
The first time you ever saw it on the big screen?
Yep. I'd been relegated to VHS tapes and DVDs and whatnot for far too long. This was a beautiful print, 35mm print.
It's a great movie, really criminally underrated movie that not a lot of people have seen. Sam Neill, It's actually one of Carpenter's scariest movies.
I concur.
When you look at some of the just on the scary level, In the Mouth of Madness is a really scary movie. And also I think one of the scariest movies that John Carpenter has ever directed. I think Prince of Darkness is a terrifying movie, like really scary.
an incredible central performance by Donald Pleasance.
Donald Pleasance, yeah. Was just great. Yeah, I always love the fact that Donald Pleasance was cast as the President of the United States in Escape from New York, despite the fact that he doesn't even hide his British accent. It just, that always cracks me up. It's like, okay, yeah, all right. I still buy it. It's Donald Pleasance, man. Yeah. But I just love the fact that Carpenter cast him and he didn't even try to do an American accent.
I mean, that's up there with Sean Connery as the Russian submarine commander.
Yeah.
With a Scotch accent.
That's right. But he's good in that movie, despite the fact of, so it's a submarine movie. So that means it's good.
Naturally.
That's how that works. So, it was a pretty nice weekend. Saw a few films that we're going to review, over the weekend. SNL premiered with a mediocre, episode. There were parts of it that I think Kenan Thompson's David Ortiz was on Weekend Update by far the funniest thing.
I was weeping.
And I also thought it was hilarious when they had the wardrobe malfunction and the actual wardrobe person came out on stage and A.D. Bryant was gone. Like that's like Debbie Downer level of breaking on stage. Like everybody was, especially A.D. Bryant, she was gone.
Yeah, it was too late. She was.
Yeah. It was very funny. Some of the other stuff was funny. I thought Heidi Gardner was hilarious as the teenage girlfriend to the coach.
Yeah, that was good. I liked that. I really thought the whole apple orchard bit
was hilarious.
So funny.
Yeah, no, that was hilarious.
Yeah,
the apple picking thing was hilarious. But yeah, it was okay. I'm looking forward to next week. Fleabag, the Phoebe is going to be hosting it, and I hope they write some good stuff for her. And I thought Woody Harrelson did a good job. He's funny.
What was your take on Billie Eilish?
No.
Teen pop star?
No.
Nothing?
No.
Not even a little bit?
No. No. I just sat there and went, yeah, I'm 54. I couldn't care. I just want this to end.
I do have to give her props for doing the whole Inception room thing. That was kind of cool.
That was a Fred Astaire tribute. Nothing. I got nothing. Hey, in the newsroom, it's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Morning, sir.
How are you, buddy?
Doing very well.
How was your weekend?
It was good. I spent it in Milwaukee's historic Third Ward wedding Saturday.
You had a wedding?
You know, it's funny because Friday was rainy, Sunday was rainy, cloudy. Saturday was beautiful for the outdoor wedding.
It was an outdoor wedding.
Good sign for the newlyweds, I think.
You know, it's supposed to be good luck if it rains on your wedding day.
Is it?
Yeah.
Ooh.
That's supposed to. It is. It's supposed to be good luck. That's
Somebody
what they
tell
say.
Well, then I don't know
what that means then, because it rained Friday and Sunday and it stopped for the wedding.
Yeah.
No, I think.
But no,
they look very much in love. It's going to be a good start for them.
And by the way, if it rains on your wedding day, that's not ironic. Somebody might want to call
Isn't
up.
It?
Somebody might want to call up Alanis Morissette. We've talked about this. Everybody's talked about this for years. Like, she does not know what ironic means.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, no, it's supposed to be good luck.
Well, you know what? It was great that it stopped, though, because they had a tent for backup just in case, but we didn't have to use it, so it was really nice.
Well, you know, my old producer, Dan Chagrew, who's happily married, it was a torrential, like, typhoon on the day of his wedding. In fact, they had no power at their reception.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got lucky.
I was here. I was here, or not here. I was, you know, obviously across the river when we were still in the Trib building. And it was a Saturday when they got married, and that was one of the years that they had to evacuate Lollapalooza because it was so bad.
Remember that, yeah.
And I remember I was looking out the window when we were in Trib Tower. I was looking out the window, and I'm telling you, the sky was like purple. It was unbelievable.
Would it possibly have been 2012?
Yes.
Okay, because I was there. I was at Lollapalooza getting evacuated, hiding in a Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah, that's when they got married. That was the day they got married.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah, and they still, Dan was happy about it. They made the best of it. I mean, the power came on about an hour into their reception. They did finally get power. But when people were arriving, there was no power.
Oh no!
That's mad.
Yeah,
that's madness.
Yeah, but they have got a great marriage. So I think maybe the good luck thing might be
probably due to the rain. Yeah,
might be. Yeah, that's what it is. That's what it was. It was the typhoon. You know what? I couldn't even. You know, you guys remember up on the seventh floor when you walk down the hallway to go to the elevators on the other bank of the elevators? There was that brown door that you could open, and it was like this open air area outside where you could walk out. Okay, well, I couldn't open that door. Because of the, I wanted to open it to see what it was like. I couldn't open the door because of the
pressure.
Yeah, the pressure.
Mm.
And then when I finally kind of got it open, like a 5 gallons of water just shot right into the hallway, and the door just slammed.
That was dumb.
It was really,
you probably thought to yourself.
No, it was. I just wanted to see what it was like outside because it was covered. You know, I mean, it wasn't an open air thing. I wouldn't have gotten. You know, I didn't think I was going to get wet, but the way the wind was whipping.
Wow.
It was crazy.
Well, that was terrifying, too, when you think about all the people that were at that concert, including our producer now.
Yeah.
But that was terrifying to think of all those people that were there that were going to have to now do a mad evacuation. That's a scary situation.
It is, but I think that they did it 3 years in a row, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Lollapalooza was evacuated because of weather. I think it was 3 years in a row.
At least two, I know.
Yeah, for sure. And I know that like this past year was fantastic weather and the year before was fantastic weather.
I've had a good little stretch.
But there was like 4 or 5 years in a row where it was like the weather was terrible.
You know, I was reading recently, too, I think it was last week, they did a report on how the cost of repairing the grounds there at Grant Park was much higher this year than in past. And I remember this year noticing, because you can see it from my window, my apartment view,
sure.
It was brown the day after Lollapalooza, and it took about a month and a half before the green started to come back.
That's a lot of people.
But it's back now and it's fine. Yeah. It's green again. But boy, I noticed it. I told Jeannie, that was green a couple days ago, wasn't it? And she came over and looked. And yeah, it was just from all the foot traffic, it just turned it brown for about a month.
Yeah, crazy. All right, well, we're here. And then we got Vic in the newsroom and we got Thomas producing and I'm your host. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Steve and Eric are going to join me. And we've got the Monday morning movie reviews right here on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we got the Monday morning movie reviews, which is coming up very, very quickly. Also, we are going to talk about the Toy Hall of Fame finalists have been announced. And we're going to talk about some of the greatest toys of all time and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. But we got to get into the movie reviews. Every Monday morning, Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me for the movie reviews, and Eric sticks around. We talk box office as well. So let's get the guys on. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Steve. Hey, Steve.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. How's everybody doing?
Good.
All right.
Awake.
All right. Let's see. Let's start with Steve, why don't you tell us about The Mountain?
Oh, gladly. So, this is the latest from director Rick Alverson, who did a couple of movies recently called Entertainment and the Comedy that were, to put it mildly, challenging and perhaps even challenged. On The Mountain, this is definitely something much more accessible, if not necessarily more agreeable. This time he's sort of taking a look at the chilling American Gothic madness of the 1950s. It starts out with this kid named Andy, who's played by Ty Sheridan, who most people know from the X-Men movies, but last year he was also in Ready Player One. And his father dies. Father's played by Udo Kier. His father dies, and he's sort of taken under the wing of this doctor. Dr. Wallace finds, and I put doctor in quotes because he's self-taught, but he's also played by Jeff Goldblum, who is playing things pretty low-key for Jeff Goldblum, or for anybody, really, but especially Jeff Goldblum. And he basically brings him on board, and they travel together, performing and documenting lobotomies. They go from asylum to asylum, basically taking care of these patients. And it's not like lobotomies like you might have today, although I don't even know if that's still a practice anymore. But it's basically the ice pick and the hammer and the corner of the eye thing. And like I said, he's self-taught, so he knows how to do this, but not much else when it comes to patient care. So anyway, they travel the country going from asylum to asylum, and Andy is taking pictures, basically. But it sort of veers into this weird sort of sneaky eroticism, it's sort of a surreal road movie, and Andy sort of goes to this coming-of-age thing when he meets this potential patient named Susan, whose father is played by Denis Levant, the French actor from Holy Motors, who is about as insane as you can possibly imagine in this film, because the guy is basically an orangutan in a human suit. But anyway, it's just like the movie kind of, as it goes, it gets progressively more uncomfortable and crazier. And whereas Alverson's other films sort of dare us not to walk out on them, and for some people, I think, there's sort of a beautiful, icy quality to this film that's very inviting and a little discomforting. Sheridan is particularly good, even though he doesn't really talk that much in the film, but he sort of knows how to glare at someone silently, observing them, judging them. He can kind of go from harmless to dangerous with very little adjustment or dialogue. And like I said before, Goldblum is remarkable here, playing very much against type, and it takes you a little to the point where it sort of takes you a little while to realize what a monster this guy is. In addition to being sort of a shocking look at the state of medicine in the 1950s, it's also a fairly bleak portrait of America. There's sort of the nation seems sort of frozen in time, and it seems like this attraction that Andy has to Susan is maybe the only thing that's going to thaw at least Andy's mind, if he doesn't go in the other direction and just completely lose his mind by being exposed to all this insanity. You know, having these two guys as lead actors in The Mountain, like I said before, makes it very accessible, maybe not commercially viable, but it's still pretty out there. It's sort of brutally grim, with an ending I don't think I could pass the test on, but it still feels right. And if you're in an experimental mood, I would say check it out. It's at the Gene Siskel Film Center.
I like his other two movies.
Yeah, well, some people do.
I do. I like both, particularly Entertainment. And you know, Goldblum was doing press for this months ago.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I mean, it's been around for a while. I remember Goldblum doing like regular talk shows to talk about this movie, and I remember watching the interviews, going, "Wow, he's on Jimmy Fallon talking about this movie," which is just seems strange.
I think he's probably happy he's not just being brought in as like comic relief or something. This is like a legitimate part that he can really sink his teeth into, and he does a great job. I mean, he's creepy as hell in this movie.
That's great. Well, he's a terrific actor. I think now that he's become like sort of a caricature, I think people forget what a great actor he is.
It's definitely a pleasant reminder, for sure.
Okay, cool. That sounds good. That's The Mountain at the Siskel Center. All right. Eric, tell us about Where's My Roy Cohn?
Okay, well, if people are not familiar with who Roy Cohn is, this documentary certainly gives you a pretty good stepping stone into this guy that is probably most known for being the assistant to Joseph McCarthy during the McCarthy hearings. What we learned more about this guy, we learn about exactly, you know, where he came from and how, as sort of one of the original dirty tricksters and a lawyer who would do just about anything conceivable, including, you know, breaking, bending, you know, destroying the law, as his means would follow. We discovered that, you know, he was doing this at a very early age. This is a guy that throughout many decades eventually got himself expanded into people that are players in today's modern political world. It's a documentary about, you know, people or other things that have been written and done about Roy Cohn. There was an HBO movie called Citizen Cohn with James Woods that I also recommend quite well. And this, you know, this is sort of a typical...
He was also, by the way, a major character in Angels in America.
Angels in America, yes. I was going to mention that as well, that it was sort of the end of his life. He was a closeted homosexual, but he was very much sort of a self-hating. Any label you could possibly put on this guy, what he really was, he was a self-hating character. And, you know, this movie doesn't exactly get into the psychological aspects of that. It basically just tells you that this guy was just a real piece of work, a real evil guy that, you know, probably, you know, destroyed as much as he, you know, possibly could have created, you know, with his own happiness or you know, building up upon his own happiness. Whether or not this guy ever was happy or not kind of remains to be seen. But the title of the movie comes from what I think this movie really wanted to really kind of delve into, which is Roy Cohn's connection to our current president. Where's My Roy Cohn is essentially something that's President Trump apparently had said at least once, maybe multiple times, in regards to Michael Cohen and, you know, people around him, Jeff Sessions and his district attorney, people that were going to fight for him, fight tooth and nail for him, even though that's not what these people in government are supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be fighting for the people, not for the president of the United States. So that's where the title comes from, and you see the movie while giving us the entire background of this guy for the better part of an hour. It really is really kind of building up to what it wants to really do, is to connect him with Donald Trump and to show that, a lot of the ills and things that we've been going through in this national nightmare that we have can be, kind of contributed back to this guy's beginnings. It's no secret that Roger Stone is a major player in this film and is interviewed, and it's kind of interesting that this movie premiered at Sundance, although I missed it there and just recently saw it this week. But at Sundance, while this movie was playing, Roger Stone was arrested while we were out there, and now this movie is opening here in Chicago, and we're in the middle of this whole whistleblower scandal with Donald Trump. So,
Eric, hang on a second.
Okay.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll find out what Eric and Steve thought of the new documentary called "Where's My Roy Cohn?" And it's out right now, and we'll talk about that a little bit more after the news right here on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago on 720 WGN. And it is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're going to be talking about the Toy Hall of Fame has announced their finalists for this year. And we'll get into that. That's going to be a lot of fun. Joe Madden is out as Cubs manager, so we'll talk a little bit about Cubs managers of the past and a little bit remembering what was so fun about having Joe Madden as our manager for the Chicago Cubs. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You want to get in? You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. It's Monday, which also means it's the Monday Morning Movie Review. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me every week to talk movies, and then we talk box office as well. Let's get Eric back in here. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, Eric, continue. You're talking about the documentary, Where's My Roy Cohn?
Yeah, so what I was getting to is that, this documentary certainly doesn't break any kind of new ground necessarily dramatically or, aesthetically. If you had told me this it was made by Alex Gibney, I would probably believe you, because it just feels exactly like all these documentaries of criminals and shady figures that we've been seeing for a number of years now. But that being said, not many people probably know the history of this guy, and when they hear that name kind of bandied about in Trump circles, they just kind of get a kind of a rudimentary idea and might know a little bit about his connection with the McCarthy hearings, or maybe they saw Angels in America, but don't really quite grasp just what a ruthless scumbag this guy really was. So I think as a history lesson, the movie pretty much does its job. Even little bits in the story that I was not aware of. I didn't know he had such a friendship with Barbara Walters, for example. That really kind of blew my mind a bit. And the fact that she was actually a character witness for him when he was about to be disbarred, which really just kind of messed me up a bit. As I said, it's nothing brand new, but it might be for some people, and I think those people would be interested in hearing a little bit more about how the past has potentially formed the present and maybe the future to come.
All right, Steve, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I did wonder at first when I heard about this film, like, why did they make a documentary about Roy Cohn today? And then the minute they hit the Trump stuff, you realize, you see the connection, and not just because Trump was a friend of his, and he was his lawyer for a time. But these are sort of bullet point playbook things for Roy Cohen. Always attack, never admit blame or apologize, you know, favors and fear to ensure support, manipulate the media, lie shamelessly just to invalidate the idea of the truth and confuse the truth, weaponize lawsuits, don't pay taxes or bills, and most importantly, one of the things out of the Cohen playbook was inflame the prejudices of the masses by scapegoating defenseless people. And these all sound like very familiar and very relevant things. You know, they often say that monsters aren't born, they're made, but I think this is a very good case for maybe one that was born. And it's fascinating, and if you can stomach it, it's a textbook profile of how not to live your life if you want to be a decent human being, because there was not an ounce of decency in this guy. He was a closeted, power-hungry, fame-hungry hypocrite. And I think the thing that got me the most, which I didn't realize about him, was that not only did he go after communists with McCarthy, but he went after gays in politics and really ruined a lot of careers that way, too, and which is shocking when you know, like, his story, that he, like I said, he's a closeted gay man. He got in trouble for that to a certain degree, but not enough to destroy him. And this is probably this is definitely a great way to examine someone like this in this sort of rearview mirror way, because I'd rather do it that way than actually have to have them running the country necessarily. But yeah, I mean, it's an enraging documentary, especially when you start pulling all of these lessons into the present and all of the realizing all of the things that are fueling our current world. So Roy Cohen is very much alive and thriving today, and the movie's terrific.
Okay. And it's playing at the River East downtown.
Yeah.
And it's also playing at the Landmark Century on Clark and in mm-hmm. Evanston at the Century in Evanston.
Yep.
Okay, cool. Where's my Roy Cohen? All right. Steve, why don't you tell us about Britt Marie Was Here?
Yes. So 3 years ago, there was this wonderful little Swedish film called A Man Called Uva, and it was released in the U.S., and it, as far as art house films go, it found a really nice, sizable audience and was even nominated for 2 Oscars, including Best Foreign Language Film. The movie was based on a best-selling novel by someone named Frederick Backman, whose works have been very big in America for some reason, although I've got some on my bookshelf here. And now this adaptation of another one of his books, Britt Marie Was Here. The story concerns a 63-year-old woman named Britt Marie, played by Pernilla August. She is a woman to whom order and routine means everything, and she has kept her house spotless and tidy for the entirety of her 40-year marriage. But clearly her husband's apathy about her hard work has taken its toll on sort of the passion in their life. After her husband has a heart attack, she goes to the hospital and finds a younger woman there by his bedside. The mistress leaves, and Britt Marie doesn't really want to talk about it, but as soon as she gets home that night, she starts packing her stuff and leaves her husband. And she doesn't really have any prospects or marketable skills outside of housework. She takes a completely unsuitable job heading up a youth center in sort of a backwater Swedish town called Borg. Her primary task is to coach a rowdy bunch of kids into something that resembles a soccer team. And the previous coach has just died and was fairly loved. So what follows is a combination of sort of an elderly woman not only discovering that she still has something to offer the world at large, but she also starts to grow to love the freedom she has and that she experiences outside of her home. If this film had been made in America, I think the life lessons would have been a little bolder and maybe more obvious. But in the hands of this filmmaker named Tuva Novotny, who was an actress turned filmmaker, Britt Marie doesn't have to go through these sort of radical changes to make her less abrasive or less passive aggressive. In a way, the world and Britt Marie kind of meet in the middle. She doesn't have her own children of her own, so suddenly having to relate to all these kids around her is something of a shock to her system. And the kids aren't—they're not like the Bad News Bears, but the struggle is real, but manageable. and the way she sort of slowly integrates herself into the town is actually really nice too. It's not forced. She moves in with the daughter of the late soccer coach, and then there's like a town councilman who wants to sort of shut the place down after the last match, even though one of his kids is on the team. And there's also, of course, naturally a potential love interest in the form of a handsome police officer. Thankfully, that story doesn't really ever become the focus of the film, but it still gives Britt Marie hope that in that area of her life, especially when her husband shows up demanding that she come home and sort of put their home back in order because the guy's all heart. So, like I said, in this country, Pernilla August is probably best known for playing Anakin Skywalker's mother in the Star Wars prequels, but she's has a really long, wonderful history of being like a preeminent actor, stretching back to like the 70s. She was in a bunch of later Ingmar Bergman films, and she never really hasn't stopped acting, although I haven't seen her in a while, and it's sort of wonderful to see her shine like this and bring her gifts as a performer capable of playing this sort of life in transition.
Okay, Steve,
yep,
hang on 1 second. We got a break here. We have a break. You guys hold on a second. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back, and Steve will tell us more about Britt Marie Was Here, which is a new movie. Movie reviews will continue right here on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here in downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. My dad's going to call in a little later and tell a joke. After 5 o'clock, you got the opening bell with Steve Grzanich. 6 o'clock, you've got Steve Cochran for your morning drive, and it is Monday morning. And we got the Monday morning movie reviews going. Before the break, Steve Procopi was telling us about a film called Britt Marie Was Here. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, Steve, continue. Britt Marie Was Here.
Just wrapping it up. So like I said, Pernilla August is just so perfect for this sort of life and transition story. It's subtle, but it's not afraid to show the challenges of upending one's world late in life, emerging from the fear of the new and finding friendships and new love. And it's a small, sweet work that finds notes of grace at times that elevate it into something that's almost inspirational. I really enjoyed it. So, and I think as far as I know, in the city, it's only playing at the Landmark out in Highland Park. So.
Okay, Landmark in Highland Park, if you want to see it. It's a Britt Marie Was Here. Okay, cool. All right, Eric, tell us about The Death of Dick Long.
Okay, this is a movie that premiered back at Sundance, and that was when I saw it, so if my details are a little hazy, please forgive me. But it's a story of three friends who, at the beginning of the film, are finishing up their band practice and basically decide to have a bit of fun, as country boys are prone to do. Involves some fire, some shotguns, a lot of drinking, and then cut to what looks like the beginning of Reservoir Dogs, with one of the friends bleeding pretty profusely in the backseat of a car, as the two guys, less concerned with how they're going to fix him and just getting him to the hospital and trying to distance himself from any responsibility to what might have actually happened to him. So the two of them end up trying to anonymously drop him off at a hospital, sans ID, and try and drop him off as a John Doe, and then go about their daily lives. Well, poor Dick Long dies, and sets up two parallel storylines with people at the hospital, including the doctors and some local police, trying to figure out exactly what happened to this guy. And then the two friends trying to live out. One of the guys has a wife and daughter, and the other guy is probably far less responsible, and is trying to keep his distance as best he can, and the two of them just trying to how they're going to explain blood in their car and blood on their clothes and where they were all night. And Dick's wife or fiance, played by Jess Wexler, doesn't know where he is and trying to ward off her suspicions about what may have happened. This is, despite the grim nature of what I just described, is actually supposed to be a comedy, and it was directed by one half of the Daniels. The Daniels, whose last film was the really terrific Swiss Army Man, and here have created another movie, at least one of them has, about a corpse. And wackiness that ensues when trying to deal with it. And I remember watching the movie at Sundance and knowing it's supposed to be a comedy and just not responding to it whatsoever, with the exception of, I think, maybe two times in the movie where I really kind of laughed quite heartily. The rest of the movie I just felt was just really flat. It's the direction of the sort of the Hicks that are at the front and center of this movie are just not particularly, it was just not that clever in the way that they were trying. I mean, I know the movie, they're not supposed to be clever, quote unquote. They're actually supposed to be very incompetent and whatnot, but there's, you know, a cleverness sometimes to incompetency. And this movie, for me, just never really reached that level. Then even over at the cops and the doctor side, it felt very little of that worked at all. And so the movie just kind of dragged itself through just one kind of less interesting predicament to the next, not even, you know, really sort of expanding upon the urgency of the issue. Some people have told me that I'm wrong on this one. I remember at Sundance not laughing much at all and walking away just kind of shrugging my shoulders and like, I'd rather watch Swiss Army Man again.
Okay. Steve, what do you think?
It is a comedy, but it's so, so dark that I don't think it's like your traditional laugh-out-loud thing. I found it very funny, and I think I more admired the film than liked it flat out. But, you know, Eric mentioned their incompetence. Their incompetence is so rich and so complete that it's almost an art form how incompetent they are. They get everything wrong at every turn, and it's not an if but when they get figured out. One of the strange things about the film is the mystery of how Dick Long actually died is not really the central point of the film. We find that out about halfway through. The fun part for me was just watching the slow wheels of justice in a town that doesn't have a sheriff, like a head sheriff, that really seems to care about anything going on in the town. The case is almost accidentally solved by a newcomer who I think is played by Sarah Baker, who I think is the standout of the film. And she has this really wonderful way of playing someone who just wants to make a good sort of first day impression on the job, but is also smart enough to ask questions the right way and appear to stumble onto the truth. And maybe she does actually just stumble onto it. What it reminded me of at a certain point, once we know the truth, but we're like the audience knows more than most everyone else in the film, is it reminded me of like an older Coen Brothers film like Blood Simple or Fargo, where like we're just sort of waiting for everyone else to catch up with us. But that's the fun of it, is just watching how the pieces fall into place in ways we're not expecting. The death itself is that might be the thing that turns a lot of people off to this. Because it's pretty out there. I don't even think we could give it away if we wanted to be honest, but, boy, do they get dark and boy, do they get strange. I loved it. I didn't know a lot of the actors in this. I knew a couple, but it was kind of fun and more believable having these sort of lesser known actors play these parts. I was drawn into it, but like I said, I don't remember sitting there laughing at it, but I definitely found it very amusing. It's less about like it's. I found it very tense toward the end as you're sort of seeing things fall apart for these two idiots. So yeah, I mean, if you can handle the way he dies and get through that, I don't know. I thought it was pretty good.
Okay. All right. So that's The Death of Dick Long, which is playing at the Arclight in Chicago. Okay. I really liked Swiss Army Man. I was a huge fan of that movie. Are there any fart jokes in this one?
I don't think so.
No? Okay.
Well, I don't know if there could be, to be honest.
Okay. Yeah. Things don't go that way. Let's just say that.
All right. You guys hang on, all right?
Yep. Okay.
All right. Eric and Steve are here, and they join me every week for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, and we will continue reviewing all the new movies right after we take this break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everyone. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time, and we got that going. And much more. We're also going to talk about the finalists for the Toy Hall of Fame have been announced, and we're going to talk about that and more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected on our Facebook page, too. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. Every Monday morning, we do the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me, and let's bring the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Steve, tell us about Abominable.
Sure. You know, especially with animated works, there are times when I might be tempted to give points to a film with a strong sort of visual sense, even if it's the story's a bit lacking. But and while the new DreamWorks animation movie Abominable certainly has a flair for color and light, and most of that's just because the film's set in China, which has these beautiful cities and these sort of mountainous landscapes and are recreated very nicely here, the rest of the film is sort of so emotionally vapid and predictable and unoriginal that I had a tough time caring about anything I was seeing. This is a story about two worlds colliding, and it opens with some sort of wild creature escaping from a scientific research facility and ending up on the roof of this apartment building where this teenager named Yi, who's voiced by Chloe Bennett, lives with her mother and grandmother, both of whom are concerned about her being out all the time and not spending enough time with the family. It turns out that Yi is secretly working a series of odd jobs to make money for a trip she wants to take, and she is feeling distance from her family after her father died a year earlier. Even when she's home, she spends a lot of time on the roof of this building, where she runs into this creature that turns out to be a Yeti. And when she finally figures out what he is, she names him Everett after the place he comes from and where she wants to return him to. The giant-sized creature is also on the run from these scientists for the whole movie. They were holding him, and the head of this facility was a doctor named Dr. Zara, who's voiced by Sarah Paulson. And the team's wealthy financier is an elderly British guy named Burnish, who's voiced by Eddie Izzard. And I will say, I was so happy I did not know he was doing a voice in this. I was happy because at least he's allowed to riff a little, so the film does get a few glimpses of actual humor, as opposed to the more childish stuff going on most of the time. I guess this guy Burnish had a run-in with a Yeti when he was much younger, but he talked about it to the scientific community, but he didn't have any proof, so he was basically run out of town by them. So Yi decides to spearhead a journey to get Everest back home, and she takes her two closest friends and neighbors with her. Basically, it's just about taking E.T. home. That's basically what this is. And they sort of discover along the way that Everest has special, perhaps even magical, connections to nature that aids them in their journey and escaping Yi's sort of struggles getting through the pain of losing her father. And that's about the most interesting thing about her, which at least gave me someone to root for during this. But honestly, I got to say, I didn't really care about the fates of any of these characters. There is some visual innovation here. Most of it's reserved for Everest. And I kind of sort of eagerly found myself waiting for his next magic trick without paying that much attention to what was going on in between. I like the way the film uses violin music, because it's not only as a score, but also Yi used to play violin. She was encouraged by her father to do so, and she sort of picks it up again on this trip as she is going through this healing process. But too much of the film is sort of formulaic, borrowing ideas from other films that might not have been worth borrowing in the first place. There's a sequence involving exploding blueberries these giant exploding blueberries that seems very juvenile and poignant and only serves to make us think of another movie involving a famous candy connoisseur. There's nothing offensively wrong with Abominable. It's just trying so hard to be unique. It's safe to a fault. It seems disinterested in its own outcome, and which is too bad, because like I said before, the setting and some of the subject matter could have really been something special, but this is definitely not.
I liked it more than you did. I didn't think it was great by any stretch of the imagination. Certainly not the most original thing in the world, but I thought it was really nicely animated. It's visually, it's really
sure.
It's really a lot of fun to watch. I liked the character. I thought Everest was fun and interesting. I wasn't crazy about her sidekicks, but I thought I thought the main character was really interesting, and I did sort of feel for her plight, the whole loss of her father, mm-hmm. and that got me. And I thought, you know, like Eddie Izzard clearly is having a lot of fun. So is Sarah Paulson. Generic villains, you know. I mean, that whole, and you're right. It's E.T. That's all it is. It's like. I mean, you know, I don't know how many times, you know, people are going to basically take E.T.'s story and just do it over and over and over and over and over again. But this is, again, another example of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that I was never not entertained throughout the movie. And there were several sequences that I thought were just, like, really beautifully done. I do have questions. I mean, I know maybe I shouldn't even question this, but I was like, if this suddenly about halfway through the movie, we discover that this Yeti has these magical powers, why didn't he use them before? You know, there's very select, you know what I'm saying, Steve? There's like very, there's very selective moments in the movie where suddenly it's very convenient for him to have like these magical powers that we didn't know he had till about 45 minutes or an hour into the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then every time he used them, I'm like, why didn't he use those? Why didn't he use those before? You know, like I said, the character I thought was, I found the character to be kind of charming and it made me laugh a little bit. But yeah, her sidekicks are annoying. Those two, the two guys, especially the kid, the little kid.
I barely mentioned them because I didn't want to get into it.
Yeah, no, the basketball kid made me nuts. But I really liked her, and I thought it was nice to have at the core of this this movie, a strong, you know, young female character to carry mm-hmm. the whole thing. I thought that was nice. But again, there's nothing original here, and if you skipped it, you can skip it. But I liked it more than you did. I was entertained by most of it, so that's Abominable. All right, there you go. And that's out right now and actually made some money over the weekend. We'll talk about that, too. Okay, let's get back to it. Eric, tell us about The Day Shall Come.
Okay, well, this is the latest film from Chris Morris, who last time had a theatrical release was this really great movie called Four Lions that I recommend people look up and see as soon as possible. But this is the first film. That was 9 years ago, so it's been a long time waiting for a follow-up to that film. And he's kind of on very familiar turf, in a way. This story is about what happens when the FBI are basically running low on cases and are trying to sort of justify their ways and means of handling terrorism in this country, and the way that they're able to sometimes manipulate things in a way to, you know, get people who are kind of, you know, half-cocked, crazy, or on the outskirts of the law, and basically, you know, just kind of build them up a little bit more, sort of manipulate them into creating bigger crimes, and then, you know, arresting them on the spot, and then being able able to just sort of justify their numbers. Anna Kendrick plays one of these FBI agents who comes across a story of this kind of low-level, you know, Miami preacher named Marshawn Davis, who, you know, is just kind of a preacher. He's got a lot. He's got a big mouth. He, you know, kind of has a little bit of a commune. He has a family trying to, you know, provide from them. But, you know, he talks a big game about revolution and, you know, taking over the country and things like that. And when they sort of get wind of him, they decide, well, let's sort of manipulate this guy into a much larger arms deal for his big revolution. And then when we catch him red-handed, we can arrest him and, you know, we're the good guys again. So, you know, we're sort of dealing with government and sort of real life exploitation of terrorism, sort of the same way that he utilized in Four Lions. Four Lions really, you know, walked a very thin tightrope and walked it quite beautifully, I thought. You know, dealing with jihadists who, you know, like the death of DeLong, happen to be, you know, really incompetent.
Okay, hang on, Eric.
And watching them having to go through what they.
Hang on, Eric.
Okay,
we got to take a break. Hold on a second. That's Eric and Steve. We're going to take a break. We'll come back, and we will talk more about The Day Shall Come right after this on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. Monday morning, that means my dad's going to call and tell a joke, and we're in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews. All right, let's welcome Eric and Steve back to the show. Right before the break, Eric was telling us about a film called The Day Shall Come. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, go ahead, Eric. Continue.
Yeah, so what I was saying about Four Lions is how it kind of walked this really thin tightrope of, you know, dealing with these real-world issues of terrorism and how the idiocy of jihadism, you know, kind of, you know, walked this weird parallel line. And Four Lions was at times screamingly funny. Chris Morris, you know, in between theatrical features, has directed several episodes of Veep, and his co-writing partner on both Four Lions and The Day Shall Come is Jesse Armstrong, who is also part of the team that created the Thick of It, wrote episodes of, and also co-wrote the screenplay for In the Loop. Watching Day Shall Come, it's kind of interesting to see how that influence of those, you know, previous projects, and including Veep, which is very fresh in people's memory, is really, they're really trying to get that dynamic.
Eric, let me ask you this. Do you watch Succession?
Yes.
Do you watch Succession?
Not yet.
Okay, you should.
I know, I have to get to it.
Okay, I just wanted to mention, because he created it. So, yeah. So,
Chris Morris? Or
no, Jesse Armstrong did.
Jesse Armstrong, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and so you can see that, you know, throughout this movie, there's several. I mean, there's a much larger ensemble that I didn't even get to. Dennis O'Hare plays the lead FBI agent, who's also very good in this movie, and especially, particularly in the FBI scenes where there's, you know, there's a lot of insulting going on. And everyone's trying to one up the other, and everyone's trying to put down Anna Kendrick for various reasons, but she's generally the smartest person in the room because she's Anna Kendrick. And you see the way that they're trying to sort of, you know, really kind of capture that rhythm. And there's one particular actor amongst the FBI group who is so bad at his delivery and everything that he does. Every time he steps into the conversation, it completely throws off the rhythm of those scenes. But thankfully, you have people like Kendrick and O'Hare to sort of bring it back up to a certain level. And I thought that there's funny stuff going on with the lead character, the revolutionary, who some people have kind of been bothered about the fact that he may have actually a mental illness. But I think that also kind of adds to, you know, what Chris Morris and Armstrong are trying to sort of reveal with the story, in the way that look at the way people are trying to exploit mental illness these days, as far as to form their own political ends. And if we're dealing with exploitation of mental illness, I'll take this movie over a movie that's opening next week any day of the year. But at the same time, it's that the movie is kind of uneven in that way. And while I laughed quite a bit throughout the movie, I couldn't shake, after I saw this at South by Southwest this year, that just how uneven the movie is in its tone with its politics and the storytelling. Although there is really funny stuff in this movie. The Jim Gaffigan shows up because now that's the law. and he's very funny in it. So it's one of these movies that I'm kind of giving kind of a partial recommendation to, because I think it is kind of good enough, and I like what he's trying to accomplish with this movie, even though it's not nearly as successful as Four Lions was. But I'm giving it just kind of a pass because Kendrick's really good, O'Hare's really good, the lead guy I think is good, and like Steve said earlier, I kind of admired what he's going for more than I entirely bought the entire concept.
Okay. All right. Steve, what'd you think?
I thought this was screamingly funny. I mean, and there were times when I wasn't sure if I was supposed to be laughing or crying a couple times, because that is the beauty. And he did the same thing with Four Lions, is you're like, is this supposed to be funny or is this supposed to be like realistic? Because there are definitely moments in this film where you're really not sure. I mean, the way that the agents are portrayed, the FBI agents are portrayed, some of them are just flat out racist and misogynistic, and all in a very sort of casual, matter of fact way that sort of implies that we're not even supposed to question whether that's true or not. It just is. And that character you were talking about, Eric, that guy, he's there to derail everything. Like that was just, oh my God, that guy was so obnoxious that I couldn't get enough of him. Like Anna Kendrick, I don't think she's been this funny ever, or at least in a really long time. She's just like rattling off the insults like she is auditioning for Veep. It's so great. And like I said, the rest of the dialogue kind of flies fast, and the plot is confusing, but I think that's part of the joke, that no one really understands everything that's going on. The plan doesn't make sense. At one point, Moses, the lead, the potential terrorist, offers to turn himself in, trying to collect a reward on himself, which is so funny. It's like ridiculous. I really loved actually an actress named Danielle Brooks who plays his wife. She's like the only person in this story that seems to have a clear sense of reality on either side of this equation. So I really liked her. And Dennis O'Hare is just so confident and so funny in this. The film is so smart. It's a little dangerous. It's kind of wicked. There's a great monologue. I think it's O'Hare that has it about arresting brown people versus black people. That is like, that's what I mean. Like, that's funny, except it's also probably true. Yeah. And it just like, not let alone like how to deal with these white supremacists that show up later. So, it's a little disjointed maybe, but I almost think that's deliberate, because this situation is disjointed, and it almost in a weird way verifies fears that you have about FBI and Homeland Security and ATF, like care more about arrests and convictions than actually solving crimes or preventing crimes. That it's about numbers more than safety. And I think this movie, I mean, it sometimes takes an outsider to show us what we're like on the inside. And I think that might be what Christopher Morris and Armstrong too have a real gift for.
Yeah, I think it's terrific, man. I laughed consistently through the whole thing. I watched it on VOD, and that's where you can mostly see it. It's on Prime Video, and it's also on demand. And I highly recommend it. I just love the style of this writing. Steve, are you watching Succession?
No.
Okay. You should, because it's great. And it has that sort of rapid fire style to it that I think is so funny and so great. I loved Four Lions and all that stuff, In the Loop and Veep and all that kind of, you know, this really sort of brutal dialogue that's delivered really quickly. I love that kind of style. And there's also a real sense of politics in this movie. And this newcomer who played Moses is great.
Yeah.
He's just terrific. Marchant Davis is great in it. And all the stuff with the FBI is really, really funny. And man, Kendrick is great in this. I mean, that kind of goes without saying at this point. Because if Anna Kendrick's in something, she's going to be good because she's Anna Kendrick. But you clearly see her having a great time spitting out this dialogue that she gets to say. I didn't have any issues with it being disjointed or anything like that. I was on board for the entire ride. I just really love this sort of smart aleck style that these guys go for, and in terms of the writing, it's really short too. I mean, it's less than an hour and a half, so it came and went really quickly. And I actually wanted more when it was over. I think this is really strong stuff, both in terms of what it's trying to say politically and socially, and also just the number of laughs in it. There are a lot of laughs in this movie. It is a very, 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 very funny movie. So that's The Day Shall Come. It is available on VOD, and I, for one, highly, highly recommend it. I thought it was hysterical. So, all right, that's The Day Shall Come. All right, you guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we got one more movie to review, and then we'll talk about the box office as well. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi join me every Monday morning for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, and we've got one more movie to talk about. It's a big one. It's the biopic about Judy Garland with Renee Zellweger, and we'll talk about Judy after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How's it going? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. And it is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about the Toy Hall of Fame. They're announcing their finalists. And we're going to talk to your favorite toys and all kinds of fun stuff. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Monday morning movie reviews continue. Steve Procopi, Eric Childress join me every Monday to review the new movies. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Steve, tell us about Judy.
Yes. I think the most important thing to know about Judy, which is a look at sort of later period of Judy Garland's life, starring Renee Zellweger as the troubled but exceedingly talented superstar, is that it's not meant to be a conventional biopic. While we do get the occasional flashback to Garland's very rough and demeaning time on the set of Wizard of Oz and just with MGM in general, the movie is actually more about how a lifetime of insecurities, especially about her weight and her looks, that were drilled into her from a young age by studio heads and her mother and other handlers, sort of took its toll on Garland. She was also troubled by substance abuse and a desire to be loved unconditionally, especially by men, which led to a lot of troubled entanglements and five husbands. But instead of basing Judy on a biography, the director Rupert Gould, who did a film a few years ago called True Story, is working from a stage play called End of the Rainbow by Peter Quilter. And I'm fairly certain the resulting film is meant to be more of an interpretive musical of Garland's final series of sold-out concerts in London in the winter of 1968. She died the next year, middle of the next year. And it's not a traditional movie musical, but the film does feature a great number of singing numbers, all performed by Zellweger, that show the variety of both Garland's singing abilities and her capacity to entrance and get lost on stage and turn in a solid show, but then also sometimes turn that show into a train wreck and leaving her devoted audience and the show's producers very disappointed. It's not, at the time, Garland didn't really have a choice about whether to play these shows. We see in the beginning, she's essentially homeless, and with no money in her pocket and nowhere to settle in with her two kids, she has to give the kids back to their father, Sidney Luft, who's played by Rufus Sewell, and he immediately starts talking about changing the custody arrangement, so she has to go on this to do these shows in London to make money. Before she takes off, she goes to visit her older daughter Liza, and who introduces her to this sort of young, handsome, would-be entrepreneur named Mickey Deans, who's played by Finn Wittrock. The two start a courtship that eventually continues when he meets her in London a few weeks later. Eventually, he becomes the fifth husband. But in London, Garland is assigned an assistant named Rosalind Wilder, who's played by the great Jesse Buckley, who was just in Wild Rose recently. And in many ways, once the film gets to London, Judy becomes almost as much her story as it does Garland's story. In fact, the story might have been a little more interesting if been told through the perspective of this outsider to Garland's life. But the two become quite close, and Wilder manages to keep enough professional distance to do her job and make sure Garland makes it to every show, well, almost every show. And she can't really control what happens on stage. But I got to say, watching every aspect of Zellweger's performance was entrancing and sometimes painful, just because of who she's playing. She captures the essence of what Garland was going through on her best and worst days. The agony of being away from her children, the joy when she was in perfect sync with her band and her audience, the inevitable meltdowns that occurred when these sort of traumatic memories of her youth come creeping back. An actress named Darcy Shaw plays the younger Garland in these flashbacks, and she's really asked to endure what amounts to bullying by MGM lackeys and even Louis B. Mayer himself, in an effort to keep her thin and pretty to play Dorothy. Again, I have no idea if these moments are accurate, but they feel authentic, and they probably happened to many young starlets in the 40s and 30s. I don't think for a second those scenes don't have a very contemporary resonance as well. Judy also captures its subject's capacity for optimism and keeping her dreams alive, both for a comeback and for love, or to come back into her life. I'm sure some will view her as delusional, and that maybe is partly true, but that doesn't stop us from rooting for her. But most of the reason the film is in any way a success is because of Zellweger, and even if ultimately the film doesn't impress you, I think her kinetic performance is damn near perfection. So a recommendation, if not a strong recommendation.
Okay. Eric, what'd you think?
Not a recommendation for me. We sometimes talk about movies that sometimes take on the personality of their lead actor or the main character that they're doing, or vice versa. And to me, it seemed like, you know, this is a movie that was also, you know, pretty pilled up as well, because I don't think this movie has a really solid focus on what story they wanted to really tell with Judy Garland, you know, with the exception of, you know, the way the one Steve described, in basically giving us the third act, for the most part, of Judy's life, that I don't think this movie really grasped exactly, you know, what was so great about Judy Garland. I don't think this movie has a really strong point of view about, you know, who this woman was, and really wrapped its arms around what I think is probably one of the greatest tragedies in Hollywood history, as far as talent and the, you know, how young she was when she died. And, you know, the scenes, to me, the best scenes in the movie are the scenes of her in youth, before we even, you know, we get to Renee Zellweger. I think that opening scene with Lou B. Mayer is a stunner. Not, you know, people, you know a little bit about Garland's history. You know, this is, you know, a story about child abuse, basically. And I think that there's a much stronger case to be made about really digging into that aspect of it and maybe splitting the time between the childhood stuff and then, you know what eventually happened to her during the last year of her life. You know, Renee Zellweger is giving her all to this performance. There's, you know, it is, sometimes it feels like impersonation, but there are other times where when she's not doing the stage stuff, and she's just kind of reacting to certain things, you know, she's really grabbing those Judy Garland mannerisms, but you can see, you know, her trying to, you know, mask the pain through humor or other things. So I think there's a lot of stuff to admire about Zellweger's performance, but, you know, we've seen a lot of movies where, you know, great performances, really great performances in movies that are able to sort of absorb the flaws of the rest of the film, and I think that this movie's flaws are there to sort of absorb Renee Zellweger's performance, which is kind of an irony given that that's exactly what Hollywood did to Judy Garland herself. You know, like this, all the stuff with Finn Wittrott, who seems to have based his entire performance on Tom Hulce in Parenthood. Just none of that stuff. I didn't want to see, you know, sit there with any more of that. I really want to see more of the relationship with their children. I thought that would have been a much more interesting thing given, you know, what she had gone through as a child. I think Jesse Buckley is completely wasted in this movie. That was really troublesome to me. It was nice to see that Renee Zellweger does her own singing in the film. I wasn't quite sure when I first started hearing if that was her or not. But, you know, I mean, you know, this movie, you know, it's certainly better than, much better than Bohemian Rhapsody, just for the sake that it's not Bohemian Rhapsody. But I think this movie has some of those same flaws, too, in that understanding the genius of this character. And, you know, when Louis B. Mayer is describing to her, you know, how great she actually is, but, you know, by essentially belittling her at the same time, you know, I think this, it kind of, you know, rubs off on us too, and I don't think we really get a great sense of just how great this talent was. And I thought it was pretty embarrassing the way they sort of worked in this homosexual couple in the middle of the film, and then used them to basically give this be a part of this climax that which I read up on, according to Liza Minnelli, actually happened. In a way, it's not quite like that. But Liza said she actually was there and kind of instigated a little bit. But, you know, I don't know if all that checks out or not. But and then it just kind of ends, and it just, like, you don't even like get the full satisfaction of like this kind of this last moment of triumph before she, you know, ends up losing her life. So yeah, I, you know, as much as I like Zellweger and I like watching her, I wish this movie had a greater focus and a greater grasp on who Judy Garland really was.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi are here. We'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Judy after this on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over Hollywood.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And it is a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's what he does every Monday morning. And we're going to be talking about the Toy Hall of Fame. and its current finalists, and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter and at Nick D Show, and Facebook at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Monday morning movie reviews are wrapping up here. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi. Eric, welcome back. Steve,
thank
welcome
you.
Back. And,
hello.
All right, we're talking about Judy, which is the film about Judy Garland. I really liked it. I really liked it. And I really liked the idea that it's just set in that small period of time in London. I thought it was a unique way to tell this to tell the story at that particular time in her career, just to have that be, you know, like during the holidays in 1968, and that's pretty much the whole focus of the movie, you know, in addition to, you know, the flashbacks to when she was young. I think Renee Zellweger is unbelievable in this movie. You know, I've always liked Renee Zellweger, but she blew me away in this movie. I think she's unbelievable. I think it's not only a great performance, but the musical stuff that she does in it is extraordinary. I think this is easily one of the best performances of the year, without question, and she needs to be nominated for Best Actress for it. It is a great performance, a great performance. And I felt for her. I was, you know, and I think the movie, I don't think the movie just comes to an end. I think there's a crescendo of feeling at the end of this film. There were people bawling in the theater. By the way, the median age when we went to go see this movie at the theater was about 80. My dad even commented. My dad's 78, you know. My dad even commented. My dad goes, "Man, there were a lot of people with walkers in the theater," and there were. It was a very older crowd. I mean, it's a movie about Judy Garland, so you would obviously expect that. But they came out in droves. The place was packed on a Saturday afternoon. And you know, I didn't even. By the way, I didn't even recognize Rufus Sewell at all. Like, I didn't
really?
Even know. I swear to you, I didn't even know it was him. Like, I didn't know until the credits. I was like, "What?" I didn't as her ex husband. I don't know. I thought Jesse Buckley was like go ahead.
That was like the role. I'd be surprised if Rufus Sewell didn't play that role.
Yeah, no, I thought he was good. I thought he was very good in it. In fact, I thought Jesse Buckley was great. I thought she, yeah. You know, I thought their relationship was really fun and really interesting and kind of the core of the movie. And you know, I was on board with pretty much all of it. I was emotionally invested in it. Really, and I thought the scene where they go back to the apartment with the gay couple was really sweet and you know, really, 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 really nice. And it kind of, you got to know both of those guys, and you got even more, you know, in depth in what Judy Garland was doing. And I loved the scene where she goes out to see them outside of the theater and suggests that they go get something to eat. I love the reaction that the two guys had, you know, when they're trying to find some restaurant that's open and then they're making bad omelets. All of that stuff worked for me. I don't know. It just did. I think one of the reasons why I was so invested, I think the main reason why I was so invested in this story is because of Zellweger. I can't say enough about her performance. It is a great, great performance, and she really captures Judy Garland. It's not imitation to me. It wasn't like watching Rami Malek. This was like to me there was a total investment in her emotion, physically, you know, and vocally. The musical numbers are wonderful to watch, and there's a particularly hard, really amazing sequence that's done in almost one take, one full take, where it's just Renee Zellweger performing, and the energy that she's giving out is incredible. So, you know, it's a biopic. You know, you've seen it before. I did think the structure was kind of interesting, that they just took that small period of time late in her life, the last big shows that she did in London. I thought that was an interesting way to do it. And I thought it all worked. I really did. I think it's a really good film, and at the center of it is a really, really extraordinary performance by Renee Zellweger. So I'm recommending it. So, all right. Next week we've got Joker, correct?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then Lucy in the Sky, right? The space movie with Natalie Portman.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Did you see that, Eric? Did that play at Toronto?
No. It did play Toronto, but that was the night I was leaving Toronto, and then my flight got canceled. So,
got it.
I didn't get to see that one.
Okay, right. Well, we'll talk about that next week. Steve, right. Thanks, man.
Thanks.
Okay, buddy, we'll talk to you next week. All right, Eric, let's jump into some box office.
Yeah.
Abominable made $20.8 million, which is not great, right?
It's not great. It's not disastrous. It's just kind of there.
Yeah.
I think they were happy to get over the 20 million threshold. We're like 1 year removed from Smallfoot. In many ways, it's the same kind of movie.
Yeah.
And that one, had like a $23 million opening and ended up grossing $83 million. I think you could probably find this one end up, you know, somewhere in the 60s. But you know, this also cost $75 million to make. So they're really going to be, you know, thrusting on those international dollars to bring it home. Smallfoot didn't turn a profit either.
Okay. Downton Abbey, $14.5 million. Man, big solid hit for the adults who are going to the movies.
Yeah, speaking of 80-year-olds with walkers, they got a 1-2 punch this week. And, it was a pretty big drop. That's kind of what I was kind of expecting it to do. But, you know what, it was a $58 million so far.
Yeah.
It's only like $25 million away from becoming Focus's all-time domestic grosser, beating Brokeback Mountain.
Wow.
And the path it's on right now, it really has legitimate shot to break $100 million. I think it might come up a bit short of that, considering the drops, this is a solid hit.
Yeah, Hustlers $11.4 million. That's up to $80 million. That's bigger than people thought, right?
This one. I mean, it had a drop last week. Not so much this week. It really kind of leveled off. Jumped back from fifth place up to third place, and this one is on a path to hit over $100 million now. So yeah, this is a really solid hit.
Wow.
For STX, who were, you know, and I don't think they're entirely out of the woods yet, but they were on the verge of being no more.
Yeah,
and you know, they still have a couple movies in the pipeline that they're not going to do Hustlers money, but this, you know, this will at least get them the money to release those other movies.
Yeah,
so that's where they are right now.
Well, that's cool. Number four, It Chapter Two, 193.9 total. Is that underperforming for the first one?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think people are not as enthused about this one as they were the first one, and it's going to, you know, pass $200 million sometime in the next week. The first one, you know, what, grossed like $350 million or $330 million, something like that. So this one's going to do $100 million less than the first movie. But all being said, you know, we're talking about, you know, like 1.2, you know, 1.3 billion between the two movies.
Right. Okay. Boy, Ad Astra. Wow. 10 million, only 35 million in 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this one's kind of headed for like a mid-50s. Landing, and you know, again, $80 million opening. It's grossed $89 million worldwide so far. I wouldn't call it necessarily a disaster by any stretch, but it's not going to make the Disney execs very happy, you know, with what the direction that their Fox movies are doing right now.
All right, Rambo: Last Blood, $8.5 million, $33 million total.
Yeah, a bigger drop than Ad Astra, it's probably going to settling probably in the mid-40s, probably, which will probably be a little bit more than what the last Rambo movie did. So
yeah.
Inflation is kind of right on par with that.
Okay. And then seven coming in here is Judy with $3 million, almost $3.1 million. But it's only in a limited amount of theaters. Did it have a pretty good per-screen average or no?
Very well. Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
I mean, 461 theaters. It did just a little over $3 million.
Oh, that's good.
And since 2000... this is only the fifth movie in theaters in an opening between 400 and 500 theaters to gross $3 million or more. It's only the fifth time that's happened.
Well, the theater
was a very impressive start.
Like I said, Eric, theater was packed. It was packed.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
And
so,
if Roadside handles this right, I think that they have another kind of genuine little hit on their hand. And clearly, they're going to be pushing Zellweger for actress.
No
so
kidding. Yeah,
exactly what they want.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. All right, Eric. Obviously, we're going to have to deal with Joker next week, and we'll talk about that.
We're going to have to deal with that.
Yeah.
God bless you, Nick.
All right, Eric, take care.
Okay.
There you go. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi will join me again next week for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Let's take a break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How you doing? We are live in the WGN Skyline studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. And we are here until 5 a.m., as I am every weekday morning. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Yeah. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. We would love to hear from you. We have the finalists for the National Toy Hall of Fame for this year. Toys are inducted every year, usually two or three toys a year, and they always announce the finalists at this time every year. And it is the National Toy Hall of Fame put out their list of the 12 finalists for toys for the Toy Hall of Fame. And we want to hear from you. 312-981-7200. We got some texts coming in already. Phone lines are open. And what was your favorite toy growing up? 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Interesting list here. And let me go down the list and I'll read some of the responses to it. Here are the 12. Are you ready for the 12 toys? And every time we talk about this, every year when they announce the finalists for the National Toy Hall of Fame, I'm always surprised that some of the nominees aren't already in there. So there's a few here that are listed that I can't believe already aren't inducted into the Toy Hall of Fame. They just seem like Hall of Fame worthy toys to me that should have been in there. So it's the Strong's National Toy Hall of Fame in Rochester, New York. They announced the 12 finalists for induction into the hall. And here they are. Care Bears. That's a very popular toy.
Incredibly iconic for the 80s.
Yeah, that's an 80s era toy.
Yeah.
The Coloring Book. There's one right there that I'm surprised is not already in. I don't know why.
And it makes me think, is that considered a toy?
Well, they have, you know what's inducted. So have you ever gone through some of the stuff?
actually have, yeah.
A stick has been inducted into the Toy Hall of Fame. They inducted a stick because you play with a stick when you were a kid.
Good old stick.
Yeah. But if we go back and look at can you find the list of what's inducted? Because there's some weird stuff that's been inducted, including stick. Hey, and speaking of stick, here it is right there. So speaking of stick, Tom, have you ever seen the movie Stick?
What's it about?
It's Burt Reynolds.
It's Burt Reynolds.
It's an 80s action movie with Burt Reynolds as Stick.
What is his... Did he earn the name Stick?
He's like a... if I remember correctly, I think he's like a bounty hunter or something. But here's what I remember about Stick. At one point, it's a ridiculous movie. This was this was mid-80s Burt, where he was doing not very good movies. He did like 5-6 movies in a row in the 80s that were not very good. And this is one of them. So Stick... there's a scene in the trailer for Stick that just, my friends and I, when we saw the movie, we almost fell off the chair laughing. He throws a glass of gasoline in a guy's face, and then he takes out a lighter and he flicks the lighter and he goes, "Now say goodnight." That's what I remember.
Remarkable.
That's what I remember.
How is this not the highest rated movie on IMDb?
That's what I remember about Stick. And also, what's his that fantastic the fantastic stuntman who passed away actually doing a he did all these because he does a stunt in Stick that's unbelievable. You saw Sharky's Machine, right?
Yeah.
All right. You know that fall that Henry Silva takes.
Right,
in that movie?
Yes, yeah.
That's this guy. That's the
okay.
That's all the right. guy. Dag is his was his name? Like if you just Google best stuntman ever, this guy he does a stunt and Stick that's just it's really breathtaking. So the best part of the movie is this guy's stunts. And say goodnight after he throws gasoline in a guy's face. But that's Stick. That's what I think of when I think of Stick. Anyway, let's get back to toys and what has been I have the whole list of inducted toys from the Toy Hall of Fame. I'll get to that in a second. But let's talk about the ones that are nominated this year that are finalists to go in. So we got Care Bears. Anybody have Care Bears out there? Did you like your Care Bears? We got the Coloring Book, which, again, I'm surprised is not in there already. You've got the Fisher-Price Corn Popper. Oh, the Corn Popper. That's the thing that you push or pull. The big plastic thing that you push or pull. It's got that glass globe on it. And it's got, you know, the balls and stuff in there. And as you walk with it, it pops. And the balls bounce off of the plastic dome. As you walk around, it looks like you're mowing a lawn or vacuuming or something. But indeed, it's the Fisher-Price Corn Popper. Next nominee for the finalists to be inducted is Jenga. Yeah, I was never good at Jenga because I got shaky hands. I always had shaky hands. So I'm not good at I'm not good at Jenga because I mean, because of my shaky hands. And I'm also could never play Operation when I was a kid because it was because I'm the absolute opposite of steady hands. I don't think Operation is actually in the Hall of Fame. I'm looking at it and alphabetically, it's not. How is Operation not in the Toy Hall of Fame? That doesn't make any sense. But yeah, I was never good at that, or I was never good at Jenga. But anyway, Jenga is a finalist this year. Magic the Gathering.
Nice.
Now, is that your generation? That's
yeah.
A 90s thing, right? So
yeah, so it's technically the first trading card game. So but there were trading cards, of course, with baseball cards, everything like that. But this was the first thing to ever formalize it into an actual game. And it came out in 1993, so the year
that's
I was
the year
born.
You were born, right.
Right. So it's been around a long time. And I used to play it growing up. When I went to the collectibles store, I wasn't getting baseball cards. I was getting these Magic the Gathering cards. And it was a lot of fun. I used to play people that basically looked and sounded like the comic book guy from Simpsons.
Sure.
But I'm not surprised. It originated the concept of a trading card game, which would be used later on for stuff like Pokemon and all that other stuff.
Okay, so that's Magic the Gathering. Masters of the Universe is now a finalist. So good old He-Man. Now, I was older, you know, I was too old to be playing with Masters of the Universe toys, but those, that I remember correctly, He-Man was massive. That was, like, massively popular. So, Masters of the Universe. Now, here's another one that I can't believe is not in. How are Matchbox cars not in the Toy Hall of Fame already? How is that possible? How are Matchbox cars not in already?
I don't know, man.
Let me check here and see if Hot Wheels are in. Yeah, Hot Wheels are in. They were inducted in 2011. Matchbox not.
What is the difference? I mean, they're both die-cast
cars.
Yeah,
they're
cars,
small,
right?
But
the Matchbox are really small, right?
No, they're roughly the same
roughly
size.
Roughly the same size?
Yeah, roughly the same size, except Matchbox are more realistic cars. Whereas the Hot Wheels are all souped up and crazy. And I was more of a Hot Wheels guy. I had Matchbox cars.
Yeah. I was definitely into the Hot Wheels.
No, Hot Wheels is great.
Especially because you get the track and everything like that. Sending it around your sister's room or whatever, you know.
You know, you'd also beat the hell out of your friends with the track. Like the track would, you know, was
that was
a nice
your idea?
Piece of, nice long piece of plastic. You can slap the hell out of each other with it. Yeah.
Man, again, the 70s. What a time.
You know, that's what we did. We used to beat the hell out of each other with the Hot Wheels tracks. And especially, like, I'm an only child. But, like, older brothers, and I should say younger brothers, have told stories on this show about how their older brothers beat the crap out of them with Hot Wheels tracks. Just slap them around, like, whip them. So Matchbox cars, a finalist. My Little Pony. That was popular.
Yeah, it came back to popularity the last decade or so.
The Nerf Blaster.
Nice.
Now, is the Nerf Blaster, does it shoot Nerf balls? Or is that the one that has the darts? The Nerf darts that fly out?
I'm guessing they're going to go for the classic darts. If this is the first time a Nerf has been inducted, they're going to go
for
the
Nerf. I think the Nerf ball is inducted. The Nerf,
like the Nerf football?
No, this is the first Nerf ball.
What was the first Nerf?
It was just a ball. It was a foam
just literally
ball.
A ball?
Yeah. Yeah, and the Nerf, and obviously the Nerf football,
right?
It's not in.
Mm.
It goes from Mr. Potato Head to Nintendo Game Boy because these are listed alphabetically. Mr. Potato Head to Nintendo Game Boy.
Well, when I think of Nerf, it's always the blaster that shoots the darts.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one that's the first. I mean, but there's also one that would shoot Nerf balls.
Yeah, a buddy of mine has ones that shoots these little horrible yellow foam balls.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I hate, they hurt.
Yeah.
Every time I go over to his house, I walk up the stairs, boom.
Yeah, and he gets you.
Yeah.
Okay, where are we at now? My Little Pony, Nerf Blaster, Risk. How is Risk not in already?
Because of the violence it creates.
I mean, that's a classic board game. That is a classic board game.
Banned in my house. Not allowed to play Risk in my house.
Why?
Because last time I played Risk, and I'm not proud of this, me and my brothers get a little competitive, get a little heated, and the last time we played Risk, I ended up punching my youngest brother square in the face. And just, I was just like, I hate this. This is stupid. And that kid's like seven years younger than me.
It's an intense, really intense game of Risk then if you're going to punch somebody in the face. I thought,
I was mad. He was pulling some serious BS with...
I thought Kramer and Newman had an intense time playing Risk.
Nothing compared to this.
All right.
So we're literally not allowed to play Risk with each other anymore.
Okay. All right, there are a couple more here for the latest finalists to be revealed for the National Toy Hall of Fame. We got a couple more on this list. We'll talk about these finalists, the nominees, and we'll talk about some of your favorite toys. What were the best toys you ever had when you were a kid? 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We got some texts coming in. We want to hear from you. Phone lines are open as well. 312-981-7200. Yeah, man. Breaking the law. Judas Priest. Love those guys. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Skyline studio here. It's a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We want to hear from you at 312-981-7200. We are talking about the National Toy Hall of Fame has revealed their 12 finalists for the Toy Hall of Fame. And they will make the announcement in November as to which two or three get inducted. So we announced so far Care Bears, The Coloring Book, Fisher-Price Corn Popper, Jenga, Magic the Gathering, Masters of Universe Toys, Matchbox Cars, My Little Pony, Nerf Blaster, Risk. Two more. The smartphone is being considered as a finalist for... Now, is that a toy? I mean, I know kids play games on them.
I mean, if we're willing to put the stick...
Yeah.
In there, which is not expressly speaking a toy, but is played with.
Yeah.
Then you have to put the smartphone because tons of kids just play nothing but games on it. You know?
Yeah.
It's basically just another version of a Game Boy or something like that.
And then the top. How is the top not in the Toy Hall of Fame? How is that possible?
I think cavemen used to play with it. It's one of the oldest.
815 area code sends in a text that says exactly that. How is the top not in already? How is it? It's 2019, and they haven't inducted the top as one of the best of one of the Hall of Fame toys? Really?
I mean, Warren Zevon's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, you know? That's
He's
true.
Basically the top of rock and roll.
So, Care Bears, Coloring Book, Fisher-Price, Corn Popper, Jenga, Magic the Gathering, Masters of the Universe, Matchbox Cars, My Little Pony, Nerf Blaster, Risk, Smartphone, and Top. Those are the 12 finalists for the National Toy Hall of Fame for this year. Through September 11th through the 18th, as part of Player's Choice, you can go to toyhalloffame.org and you can vote. And then the public will all be counted as one vote. One member, basically. There's a 23-member committee, they will have a celebration. They will be announced on Thursday, November 7th. There'll be a public celebration on November 9th and 10th when they induct two or three or some from that list of 12. So 312-981-7200. What do you think of this list of 12? Of these toys. Are these Hall of Fame-worthy toys? What are your favorite toys? Let's go to Lisa on WGN. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. My father was a champion of that game. Jenga. He absolutely loved that game. He was a dentist, so his hands were absolutely perfect. Ah. He rarely lost, and he'd get to the very top, and he still wouldn't lose. I can't tell me how many times he beat me on this game.
Yeah.
It was absolutely ridiculous.
Wow. So he was Jenga champ.
Absolutely. Even after he had a stroke and he got his movement back in his hands, he was still able to play this game.
Wow. Geez, that's something. That's amazing.
Yeah, he beat my husband. He beat me. He beat my mother. Anybody that he played.
Yeah.
He would just beat. It was incredible.
Wow, there you
go. I had to say that.
Okay. Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome.
All right, have a good morning. Wow, Jenga champ. It's the kind of guy you want on your team.
He's gotten, you know, steady as a rock.
It's funny when whenever we would play like specific trivia games and stuff like that as teams, and you would always like if we were playing, because I have the Seinfeld Trivial Pursuit, I have the Seinfeld Seen It, I have the SNL Trivial Pursuit, I have the SNL, I have the, you know, and nobody wants to play with me. They're like, no. Or if they do, they're like, well, I want to be on your team.
Yeah, that's an uphill battle, Nick. I'm not gonna lie to you.
Yeah. I don't blame you if you don't want to play against me and like SNL trivia, because it's, I mean, you know, it's like my favorite show. So, let's see. 630 area code says, my favorite toy growing up was Matchbox cars. I had a huge collection. I couldn't wait to go to the store with my mom and look to see what the latest car or truck was on the shelf. I did the same thing. But I had more Hot Wheels than I had Matchbox. 301 area code says, my favorite toys when I was a kid, the Great Garloo. What? The Great Garloo, G-A-R-L-O-O. What is that? The Man from Uncle Gun. Okay. Fireball XL-5 spaceship. G.I. Joe and space capsule. What is the Great Garloo?
It appears to be a creature not unlike the creature from the Black Lagoon. It's a
gill man?
Sort of. He's green, scaly. Doesn't have as much of a fish face, though. More of a kind of a goblin head.
Is it an action figure?
It looks like it. It looks like he kind of just claps his hands, maybe?
What?
It's very odd.
How have I not heard of the Great Garloo?
It looks like something that Bill Leff would probably have in his collection.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. The Great Garloo. Okay. That's a new one on me. I've been talking about these toys on this station for many decades, in fact. And I don't know if we've ever spoken about the Great Garloo. If we have, I don't remember it. Who remembers the Great Garloo besides our 301 area code? 804 area code says, greetings. How long has there been a Toy Hall of Fame? Stick, marbles, jacks, pogo stick, and teddy bear worked back in the day, now probably too dangerous. Let's see. I don't know how long it's been around. I think it's been around like 20 years or something like that, maybe late 90s.
The first class was 1999.
Yeah. Okay.
So exactly 20 years.
So it's been 20 years. So that's how long they've been around. But, those are the 12 that they want to induct. And I've got a list of all of the toys that have been inducted, and it's in alphabetical order. So if you have a question of, like, hey, is this inducted? I can help you out with that. But, yeah, you guys can vote between, you can't because it's passed already, September 11th through the 18th, because it's the 30th right now. But they will announce this on Thursday, November 7th. Which ones will get in? Again, really quickly, Care Bears, Coloring Book, Fisher-Price Corn Popper, Jenga, Magic the Gathering, Masters of the Universe, Matchbox Cars, My Little Pony, Nerf Blaster, Risk, Smartphone, and Top. You can check out toyhalloffame.org, toyhalloffame.org, for more information on the nominees and the inductees. So, all right. You know, somebody obviously mentioned G.I. Joe's. That was, you know, when I was growing up, that was the toy, was the G.I. Joe. I had a bunch of G.I. Joe's. And I'm not talking about those little G.I. Joe's, the fake G.I. Joe's from, like, the 80s when they were little. and, you know, and they had that Cobra dude or whatever. I'm talking about the real G.I. Joes that were about 13 inches tall and had the lifelike hair and the kung fu grip. That's the real G.I. Joe. So, all right. More toy talk after we take a break for the news, which is coming up after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. It is Monday morning, so that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey-jokey time. He tells us a joke every Monday morning. Also, we are playing back the Blackhawks Express from the exhibition game from yesterday in Berlin. After every game, we always play back the morning after. If there's a game before the day or the evening before our show, we always play back the Blackhawks Express. Fun game in Berlin, and we will play the Blackhawks Express, and you'll hear all the highlights from that game. That'll be coming up before the end of the show as well. Right now, we are talking about toys. The 12 finalists for the National Toy Hall of Fame this year have been announced. We've gone through them. And now we want to talk about your favorite toys and what were your favorites that we had growing up. And I do have the entire list of all the inducted toys. And also, Insider.com put together a list of the greatest kids' toys ever invented. And we're going to discuss that, too. So we're talking toys here. And everybody's had toys. Everybody played with them. And everybody loved a certain amount of toys when they were growing up. And as I said before the break, it was all, for me, you know, the number one, I would have to say, would be G.I. Joe. And as I said before, the real G.I. Joe, not the G.I. Joe with the Cobra dude or whatever the hell that is, the movies are based on.
Oh, man, I love the Cobra stuff.
No, no.
That was cool.
That's not real G.I. Joe.
Okay.
Real G.I. You know what I'm talking about? Real G.I.
Yeah,
Joe?
I know.
Real G.I. Joe.
With a kung fu grip.
Kung fu grip, lifelike hair,
mm-hmm.
The scar.
That hair that they use on, they must use that on Brian Urlacher now, you know?
That's, yeah. So there was also, and I had all of that stuff too. I had the Jeeps. I had the G.I. Joe headquarters that would open up. I had all of that stuff.
I was big into G.I. Joe, but we didn't, since I grew up in the UK partially, we didn't have G.I. Joe. We had Action Man, which was like G.I. Joe.
But he was called Action Man.
He was called Action Man. Mm. And he did all the same, you know, you could get one where he's, you know, he's got like a shark with lasers on his head or something like that.
Yeah.
Or he's in the jungle or something. But I loved it. I loved the dolls.
Yeah, no, it was, but I was like, again, I was Captain Destruction when I was a kid. So I used to blow my dolls up and set them on fire and stuff. Like, oh, they would be in, you know, they would be in battle situations and then get their hair set on fire and stuff. But
was there like a little G.I. Joe graveyard in the back?
You know? Yeah, I mean, yeah, arms would fall off inevitably, and you know,
good lord,
because you know, you play, like I said, man, growing up in the 70s, it was about danger, destruction, and near death.
Pure
I'm talking
mayhem.
About for the kids.
Yeah, man,
yeah. All right, we got some people who are calling in. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Hi, Nick. I'm calling from Eastern Iowa.
All right.
There used to be a toy called Building Bricks, which predated Legos, and these bricks came in a can, and you could build, like, little houses with them.
Mm.
And they had a paper in it that was like a blueprint, and they indicated what bricks you needed in order to build certain houses. But they had one house that was a real grand house. It had, like, three stories, and you had to have, like, three cans of the bricks or something
yeah.
in order to build it.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
Like, you know, thousands of them.
Yeah, another. We did a lot of building when we were kids, because Lincoln Logs were really popular when I was a kid too, and you build stuff out of the Lincoln Logs too.
These bricks came from a company called American Toy Company, which I think was in Chicago, but I didn't see them after 1970. I think the company was absorbed by another company.
Yeah. All right.
Have you ever heard of Motorific?
Motorific, yes.
Boy, that was a real neat toy. That was. I can't say what company put that out, but I know that DX gas stations used to have a Christmas premium, and you could get a starter set of that.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to have a bigger track, you had to send in more money and add on to that.
Yeah.
But it was a battery-powered car, and the batteries never lasted very long. Like, you get it on Christmas Day, and then the batteries would run down, and you had to wait till the next day in order to get more batteries.
Right. That's true. That's very, very true, Motorama. Okay, John, thank you.
Okay. Have a nice night. Bye.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. Reminiscing here about toys, because the Toy Hall of Fame has announced their 12 finalists for this year. And here's Rose on WGNI. Rose.
Hi there.
Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
As far as the list goes, I'm going to have to vote for Coloring Book.
Yeah.
And just because that is something all kids do from the time they can pick up a crayon.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite things to do was the Highlights magazine.
Sure.
That you would find in the dentist's office and
yep.
doctor's offices.
Right.
And they always had the word finds and the picture, you know, search in the picture.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, a lot of bratty little kids would go ahead and circle everything and fill them all in and mess it up for everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Coloring Book, I'm surprised Coloring Book's not already in, as I said. I'm surprised it's not already in the Hall of Fame.
Well, yeah, maybe they never considered that a toy, but I mean, that's something that, you know, all kids grow up
that's
with
right.
that.
That's
from,
right.
You know, from the time, even before you're in preschool or
yeah.
whatnot.
Yeah. All right, Rose, thanks.
Okay. Oh, do you have a second?
Real quick.
Oh, I was just going to say, you mentioned Lincoln Logs, and that was my favorite toy growing up.
Oh, okay.
Because
yeah.
we used to make Lincoln Log villages, and we would play with our snakes and toads and salamanders out in the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
We'd make little Lincoln Log villages, and those were the best toys ever made.
Lincoln Logs are still popular. All right, Rose, thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Yeah. What about you? What were your? Did you have a favorite toy when you were a kid, Tom? Because you're much, much younger than me.
I was a fan of Legos, but not for the buildings. I really liked the little people that came with them. Like, I'd follow the instructions and build the buildings, but there's a lot of people that they get the Legos and they just let their imaginations run wild. I would build the buildings, but I really loved the little figures that would come with
them. So then you must like the movies then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was like my child. That was my what was going on in my head when I was 7 years old.
The first, well, actually, both Lego movies are great. The generic Lego movies.
Yeah.
With Chris Pratt.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is great. The first one was just like everything is awesome. I that movie came out of nowhere. I had no idea that it was going to be that good.
I took my girlfriend to go see it for Valentine's Day, and I was kind of nervous because like, oh god, she's going to think this is so dumb. And
yeah.
we had a blast.
It's so good. It's so good. The Lego Batman movie is good too.
Ninja one was okay.
It was okay. It was okay. But nobody went to see the second Lego movie.
No.
The straight up sequel to Lego movie, which is great. The second one's great.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
No, that's one of those movies. It was a genuine surprise. I mean, you think, oh, they're going to make a Lego movie, animated like Lego movie. I'm like, well, is it just going to go straight to video? You know, I mean, it was one of those things where it's like, what is this? That was a genuine surprise when I saw that movie about how witty and funny it was. So, 630 or 773 area code says, my favorite childhood toys were Transformers, He-Man, and Lincoln Logs. Yeah, Transformers, I'm too old for Transformers. Maybe that's one of the reasons why I hate the movie so much, because I never played with the toys. I don't even, you know.
That was a genuine phenomenon. People went nuts
oh, yeah.
on the Transformers.
Yeah. Well, the toys came first, then the animated series, right? And then the stupid Michael Bay movies.
Yeah, it was a genius bit of marketing, though. Like, they were just, what if we created an entire story around a set of toys.
Yeah.
And people bought into it like crazy.
Joliet Mike says, one of my favorite toys were those balsa wood planes. Oh, I love those. They lasted about 5 minutes before they were broken to pieces. That's true. But that was true of a lot of toys back in that day. As I was saying, because it was like, you know, you grew up in the 70s, everything was about destruction. 804 area code says, rubber ball against the wall and pitching copper pennies on the sidewalk. I did all that. Yep.
Did you ever do the pennies on the railroad?
Yeah. Yeah, because we had... I grew up right off of... not very far from Ravenswood. And so there's a metro track right there. We would climb up there and... we did all kinds of dangerous stuff. We would hang from the bottom of the L track. Because I lived right next to the Addison Brown line. There's a greenhouse right next to the Brown Line stop on Addison. That's where I grew up. And so we used to hang out under the tracks. And like I said, there was after the blizzard of 79, in January of 79, we got like a ridiculous amount of snow. They plowed it underneath the L tracks. So there was a mountain of snow where we could actually touch the bottom of the L track and hang from the L tracks.
I'm surprised you got all your fingers.
It's ridiculous. It is truly ridiculous. 608 area code says, one of my favorite toys growing up was the Light Bright. Always wanted to get new pictures to fill in. Yeah, the old Light Bright. You ever play with a Light Bright?
Yeah, but we would usually just spell out words like fart on the Light Bright. And be like, haha, look.
Yeah.
Look how funny that is.
You wouldn't do the generic clown like they have in the commercial?
No.
There was always like a clown. I can't remember what were the other pictures that you could make with the
Light
Bright.
They did everything.
But I just remember the clown. That's the one that I remember. I think clown was actually on the box.
I believe.
I think the clown picture that you can do on your Light Bright was actually on the box. Steve in PA says, snowball is a fun toy, and mud ball, too.
Love a good snowball.
Well, if you're going to put a stick on the list. 312 area code says, do slot cars count as toys? If so, they get my vote. Yeah.
Those are awesome.
They're fantastic. That's what the Hanson brothers play in Slapshot. They're playing slot. Well, if you're gonna cheat, and then they brought their effing toys with them. Those Hanson brothers playing slot cars. 847 area code. I like click clacks. Oh yeah, there's another toy that you can kill somebody with.
Click clacks.
Click clacks are hard plastic balls that are held together by a long string, and you manipulate it so that it slaps these hard plastic balls together.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You can kill somebody with them. You can kill somebody with them. You know, one errant ball flies up, hits you in the mouth, there goes your teeth. It's going to knock your teeth. Because they were hard. I mean, like, really hard plastic balls. Has Log been inducted? Oh, you mean from Ren and Stimpy. Yeah.
Well, you got to get Log. You got to get Ball in a Cup. Yeah. Everybody's favorite game, Ball in a Cup.
Click clacks. I just remember those. I had them. We all did. I'm surprised I didn't lose a testicle. I'm telling you, with those things. You just smack you right in the groin. Click clacks. Who invented click clacks and thought it was good for 7-year-old kids to have two really unbelievably super hard plastic balls smashing together in front of their face? That was the toy. That was essentially what the toy was. It was a different time, man.
It was the good old days.
The good old days when you could die while you're playing with a toy. You can kill your best friend with a toy. So, all right, we're going to take a break. The Toy Hall of Fame has announced their 12 finalists for this year, and we are talking about all of the toys. I've got the inducted list of all the toys that have been inducted, so we'll go through those. And we also have an article from Insider.com about the greatest kids' toys ever invented. Which ones did you love? 312-981-7200. Did you ever have dangerous toys like we did when we were growing up in my generation? All right, 312-981-7200. Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Skyline studio this morning. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We've got a Blackhawks Express from the exhibition game in Berlin yesterday and much more. We're talking about toys right now. The National Toy Hall of Fame has announced their 12 finalists to be considered for induction this year. And we're talking about some of your favorite toys. My friend Dan Long and I, not the Dan Long that works here, but the Dan Long that I was, he was my best friend when I was a kid. My best friend when I was a kid was Dan Long. Now we have a Dan Long that works here. He's an engineer and he's a very cool guy. Anyway, we used to, just go into his garage and like, try to chop stuff up with axes. And, you know, the garage floor was like cement, so sparks would fly when we would hit the... So we spent a good portion of one morning trying to chop a golf ball in half with an axe. because we wanted to see what was inside the golf ball. So here we are. We're like 10, 11 years old. We got
swinging an axe.
We're swinging a big axe in the garage. Sparks are flying off the cement floor. We did, in fact, cut a golf ball in half. You ever cut a golf ball in half?
No. What does it look like?
There's tightly wound string.
Mm.
And so as soon as you cut it in half, it just spools out. Yeah.
We used to mess with, I grew up next to a golf course.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to go to this place called Donnelly's Wild West Town. And they would sell cap guns there. And we thought it would be really funny to go hide in the, like, you know, there's certain shrubbery and trees on the golf course. Not unlike the movie Jackass, and just hide in the bush, wait till they were about to take their big swing, and then fire off cap guns like crazy. And we got chased.
I'm sure you did.
I got a 9-iron thrown right next to my face.
Oh, yeah.
Only about 13.
Yeah. No. Those scenes in Jackass where they've got the blowhorn are hilarious. But, yeah, so axes were good. We're big. 309 area code says dissecting Stretch Armstrong. Yes, you had to cut open the Stretch Armstrong because you had to know what was inside it. I remember when I was younger, I took a Stretch Armstrong out of the box at a store. Took two of them out of the box at a store, and at one end of the aisle, I tied his arm to one pole and then stretched it all the way across and tied it to another pole, and then at the end of the other end of the aisle, so I had two Stretch Armstrongs that were all stretched out, blocking the aisle, and the security was not happy with me. But you had to open up the Stretch Armstrong.
What was inside the Stretch
Armstrong? Like gel, glue. It was like gooey stuff.
And that's what made him stretchy.
Yeah. Doug says, good morning, Nick. How about the large cardboard box? Yeah, that's actually on the list. That's actually on the toy list.
No way.
Yeah.
Not just great for cats, great for human children.
847 area code says, it's like on Seinfeld when his parents couldn't afford a G.I. Joe, they got him an Army Pete. And it was made out of wood and it would split when it got wet. That's right. That's from the Merv Griffin episode where Kramer's got the Merv Griffin show set in his apartment. Which, by the way, is a hilarious episode. 708 area code says, my top five favorite toys as a kid in the 80s, Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars from Mattel, DC Comics Superpowers from Kenner, Star Wars from Kenner, He-Man Masters of the Universe from Mattel, and Universal Monster Figures from Remco. Yeah, I had the Universal. I had the Aurora models, the classic Aurora models. I had all of the Universal Monster Aurora models. By the way, man, what a pristine print of Dracula Svengoolie showed on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah, I watched it.
Oh.
Very happy.
Man.
Do you think he'll ever show the Spanish version?
I would love for him to show the Spanish version. He did talk about it.
Yeah.
In between, how Sven always does, like, facts and stuff about the making of the movie. He did talk about the Spanish version and how it was shot at night on the same sets as the Lugosi English version. But, yeah, no, I think the Spanish version is better. Actually,
I mean, you gave me the opportunity to watch it, and it was really a treat.
Oh, it's great!
It's
really great,
and it literally is different.
Yeah,
it totally different.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, I love it when Sven shows the old Universal classics. That's just great. I love those movies. 630 area code says, Nick, do you remember Johnny Lightning 500 Racetrack? Johnny Lightning 500 Racetrack. 269 area code says, I got a Seagram's bag full of marbles that I could spend hours playing with. Yeah, marbles. It's funny how those Seagram's bags were used for so many different things. You familiar with the Seagram's bag?
Is it any relation to the whiskey?
Oh, yeah, that's what it comes
that's
in.
That's what it came in. All
does
right.
it still come in? I mean, does I a mean, bottle of Seagram's still come in the purple bag?
Like the Seagram 7?
No.
Or no. Now it just comes in plastic bottles, like giant plastic bottles.
I'm sure that they still sell it.
Probably.
It was a Seagram's. I don't know if it was. It might have been scotch and not whiskey. I'm not sure. But anyway, it was a Seagram's bottle that had a special shape to it, and it was sold in a purple, like a velvet, purple bag with a string tie on top of it. That's what it was. And then you would keep the bag after you were finished drinking the booze. You'd throw the bottle out and keep the bag and you put stuff like in it.
Would it go over Crown Royal?
Crown Royal. That's what it is. Crown Royal.
Yeah.
Is that what they still sell that in a bag, right?
Yeah. I'm looking at some photos of Seagram's Crown Royal. I don't know if Seagram still owns Crown Royal brand, but it's definitely Crown Royal.
And it comes in a bag, in the purple bag. And you would put like poker chips. People would keep poker chips and stuff in it, or marbles.
Dice.
You would keep certain things in your Crown Royal bag. 847 area code. Milton Bradley's Big Track Programmable Tank was one of my favorites. 309 area code says, I enjoyed pickup sticks. It took the same kind of dexterity as Jenga. Yeah, I wasn't good at pickup sticks either. Anything where you needed a steady hand, or anything where you need a steady hand, I'm not good at. Still not good at. I've always been very, very shaky. Always.
But this is my shooting hand.
Yeah, right, exactly. Blazing Saddles. All right. Okay, why don't we take a break? By the way, coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. We'll take a break and we'll come back. We'll throw it to news right after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Is it Hard Rock Monday this morning? It seems to be the theme for all the bumps that you've been playing.
It's going a little Metal Monday.
Monday. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It is a Monday morning, and we're live in the Skyline studio. Monday, that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Every Monday, my dad calls in and tells a joke. We'd like to start your work week off with a laugh. And also, we got a Blackhawks Express from yesterday's exhibition game in Berlin. We'll play that as well. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. We want to hear from you guys. We've been talking about toys because the National Toy Hall of Fame has announced their 12 finalists to be inducted into the Toy Hall of Fame. So we're talking about our favorite toys growing up, some of the craziest stuff. And I've got a list of all of the inducted toys that belong in the Hall of Fame, and we'll get to that. But we've got people who are calling in and texting, and we want to hear from you. Here's Trucker Rich. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Nick. How are you guys doing tonight?
All right.
You know, I'm a few years older than you, I think 5 or 6, but we're lucky to be alive with all the toys we had back in the 60s, because most of our toys were derived from weapons.
Yeah.
You know, like the yo-yo, that used to be a weapon back in the Middle Ages. You know, they'd use it throw it like a rock, but you'd have a string on it, so it'd come back. And those click-clacks, those were used by South American cowboys to capture cattle or whatever.
Yeah.
They'd throw them around the back legs, and then jarts. And, I think I've told you before, my older cousin had a chemistry set that actually came with a Geiger counter and radioactive material that if you lost it, you could send in the coupon and get another chunk of radioactive material.
Right. Yeah, no, that's real. That's a real thing.
Yeah. And watching the Hawks play Berlin yesterday, my wife was watching it. She says, are those guys wearing NASCAR fire suits from Berlin with all the sponsors tags sewed on them?
Yeah.
I mean, I hope the NHL doesn't go to that.
I don't think that's going to happen. All right, Rich, thanks.
Right. Yep, have a good one.
Yeah, all of those toys that he described, absolutely true. Seriously, it's amazing that people who are over 50 and played with toys back in their childhood is still alive. It's completely insane. Because I know you were completely stunned by, especially when Rod Pyle's a few years older than me, we were talking about the kind of toys that we would play back in those days, and you'd be like, what?
The chemistry set alone.
No, it's true.
It's like, you can make your own gunpowder.
Yeah.
I mean, who was thinking about that? Welcome to Mattel's Agent Orange.
Yeah.
Here you go, kids.
Yeah.
Here's some napalm.
Gotta grow up, man. Got to grow up sometime.
Yeah, I guess.
Here's Barbara on WGN. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, he already mentioned the yo-yo.
Yeah.
And also Easy Bake Oven.
Yeah, the Easy Bake Oven, which is just basically a light bulb inside a box.
I know. And the food smelled good, but it tasted like...
Yeah. My cousin had an Easy Bake Oven. She... and she used to use it all the time. But it was a very incredibly popular toy, and it's actually in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Okay, good.
All right, Barbara, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So here's the list of the toys that are in the Hall of Fame. And again, some of these are a little strange because some of them aren't really even considered toys. You know, they were played with as though they were toys. So that's why they qualify for the Hall of Fame. Some of them are a little weird. All right, but here they are, the inducted toys of the Toy of Hall of Fame. And if you want to join us with your favorites, we've got a whole bunch of texts here that we're going to get to, and the phone lines are open. It's 312-981-7200. Alphabet Blocks. They were inducted in 2003. Atari 2600 Game System was inducted in 2007. Baby Doll was inducted in 2008. See, some of these, as we were talking before, like the Top is a finalist this year. And as I was saying earlier, how is the Top not already in the Hall of Fame? And how did a Baby Doll not get inducted until 2008? By the way, this all began in 1998. So how is that possible? Okay, the Ball, inducted in 2009. Barbie was inducted in 1998. The Bicycle was inducted in 2000. Big Wheel. I had a Big Wheel.
I had a Power Rangers Big Wheel. Love that thing.
2009 was inducted. What was the green one? It was like a... You weren't... this. I don't think this toy... You don't remember it because you... But it was like... They brought out this... It was like a Big Wheel, but it was green, and it had like a brake lever, so you could skid out on it.
You still got some of those.
It was like called Green Machine, maybe. Does anybody remember that? It was like a Big Wheel, except it had that brake on the side that you could pull, and then you could skid out.
Yeah, the Huffy Green Machine.
Green Machine, there it is.
Yeah.
The Blanket was inducted into the Toy Hall of Fame in 2011. Bubbles were inducted in 2014. Candyland, the game Candyland, 2005. The Cardboard Box was inducted also in 2005. And again, that's not really considered a toy, but people played with them, with boxes. Checkers were inducted in 2013. Chess was inducted in 2013. No, Checkers 2003. Clue, the game, was inducted in 2017. Crayola Crayons, inducted in 1998. The Dollhouse was inducted in 2011. Dominoes were inducted in 2012. The Duncan Yo-Yo was inducted in 1999. I used to have a pretty good selection of yo-yos when I was a kid.
Did you ever take like a yo-yo in class?
Not a class, but I did learn tricks and stuff.
Yeah, I took a class at an elementary school. It was just a thing you could do over the summer. You sign up for like 4 weeks. You get to take some classes on something.
Well, I had the Duncan Butterfly was one of my favorite ones. The Duncan Imperial is the yo-yo. Is the Duncan Imperial. You ever have the yo-yo that would like kind of light up when you throw it down? Dungeons and Dragons, inducted in 2016. Easy Bake Oven. The Erector Set in 1998. Etch-a-Sketch, also 1998. Fisher-Price Little People. The Frisbee was inducted in 1998. Those were the first years. G.I. Joe, inducted in 2004. How is it possible that the G.I. Joe was not inducted like the first year possible? The Game of Life, 2010. Hot Wheels, 2011. The Hula Hoop, 1999. The Jack in the Box, 2005, was inducted. Jax, they were inducted in 2000. The Jigsaw Puzzle, 2002. Jump Rope, 2000. Kite, 2007. Lego, 1998. Lincoln Logs, 1999. Lionel Trains, 2006. Little Green Army Men, 2014. Magic 8 Ball, last year. Got inducted last year, the Magic 8 Ball. Marbles, 1998. Monopoly, 1998. Mr. Potato Head, 2000. Nintendo Game Boy, 2009. The Paper Airplane, 2017. Pinball, last year. Play-Doh, first year it was possible it got inducted. Playing Cards, 2010. A Puppet, 2015. Radio Flyer Wagon, 1999. Raggedy Ann and Andy, 2002. Rocking Horse, 2004. Roller Skates, 1999. Rubber Duck, 2013. Rubik's Cube, 2014. These are all in the Hall of Fame. Scrabble, 2004. Silly Putty, 2001. The Skateboard, 2008. The Slinky, 2000. Star Wars Action Figures, 2012. And that's probably one of the most popular toys of all time, those action figures, the Star Wars action figures. I mean, they couldn't keep them on the shelves. Stick, starring Burt Reynolds, 2008. The Super Soaker, 2015. The Swing, 2016. The Teddy Bear, 1998. Tinker Toy, 1998. Those are, again, the first year possible. Tonka Trucks, 2001. Twister, 2015. Uno, 2018. Viewmaster, 1999. And the Wiffle Ball, 2 years ago, was inducted. What about the Wiffle Bat?
Nah, man, just the
ball. Well, the Wiffle Ball comes with a bat. It's attached.
Yeah.
That's another thing we used to beat the crap out of each other with.
Yeah, because it was like a plastic bat.
Yeah. The wiffle bats, we'd smash each other with them. Then you had them big, fat Wiffle Bats. You remember the big, fat Wiffle Bat? Because you got the regular, like, sort of, you know, tan, skinny, you know, Wiffle Bat. But then they had them big, fat ones. Those are the ones where you can really belt your friend in the eye.
Do some damage.
Oh, yeah, that's when you can knock a tooth out, bust a face.
Ah, the innocence of childhood.
That's it, the 70s, man. If you didn't come home with an injury, it wasn't a complete day of play. That was the objective, was to get injured when you went out to play in the 70s. If your mom didn't have to fix you up and put some Mercurochrome on your face, it wasn't a full day. So, all right, if you want to join us, it's 312-981-7200. Some lines are open. Get your text in. Got a bunch of texts here we're going to read, and we are talking about some of the best toys ever and some of your favorites. 312-981-7200. Oh, yeah. All right. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, having some fun this morning. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad is going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And we've got a Blackhawks Express to play back from yesterday's exhibition game in Berlin. That'll be fun to listen to. And 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We are talking about toys. The National Toy Hall of Fame has announced their 12 finalists for induction consideration this year. And so that got us talking about toys and stuff. And we want to hear from you. Bunch of texts here. Is Dave says, Nick, we always put models together, played with Army men, and of course had a BB gun. Yes, BB guns. Fun. Tom from Bartlett said, I used to have an old Army tank, and it was called Tiger Joe Battery Operated. The battery case looked like a walkie-talkie when it would shoot shells that you filled with either flour or baking soda, and my mom used to get pissed when you fire across the room and hit the rug. Um, 847 area code says, I played with jarts all the time. I once accidentally got one stuck in a newly aluminum-sided garage. I had to hide when my father got home. I was about 8. Yeah. You know, jarts are outlawed now.
Are those lawn darts?
Yeah, lawn darts, so, yeah. Or jarts, yeah.
Jarts.
I mean, you know, you're throwing like a giant metal dart at someone's eye. Like, there was reports that one would get stuck in the top of somebody's head, like they'd throw it way up in the air and it would come back and get stuck in the top of their head, and feet were damaged. Many feet were damaged by jarts. So now, if I'm not mistaken, you can order the parts to put together jarts. You can't purchase jarts assembled. I think you have to order them through Canada, and they come unassembled. Like, in case you really have a hankering for some jarts. I wonder if people still have jarts, like, in their garage or in a closet somewhere.
Like a jart speakeasy, you know?
Yeah.
Come on over,
man. Used to play it all the time. In the 80s, we played it all the time. 847 area code says, when you mentioned the segment earlier, instead of racking my brain back to use, what I did really enjoy was, I remembered, and due to the tropical nature of which made me, I think they meant topical, not tropical, made me think of the Bobby Hull official hockey game. I still have the game in the original box. It was the Cadillac of rolling puck hockey games. Did you ever have the game? You ever have the you know that scene in Bogus Journey, Bill and Ted Bogus Journey, where they're playing death,
mm-hmm.
and they play that football game, which just vibrates. And the you ever play that game?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
this is one of the stupidest games of all time.
I know, but it was a lot of fun. I got that secondhand from like my neighbor or something.
We used to. I used to play it when I was a kid, but it's just like you turn it on and the whole thing vibrates, and you don't know where the little you know football player pieces, which are on this vibrating piece of metal. This is ridiculous. Here's Mark on WGN. Hi, Mark.
Greetings from Cleveland.
Yes.
Do you remember the action figure line from 1986 called Centurions?
I do not.
Okay, it was a concept that really deserved to be more successful. You had three good guys with interchangeable sci-fi weapons attached to their armor, and they also had geared mechanism in their chest so that the various accessories could rotate, pulsate, and launch missiles. And then the two villains were cyborgs, and their bodies came apart, so you could take one cyborg half and attach it to the other's body.
Hmm. Okay, I don't remember that at all.
Yeah, it didn't do too well against all the other competition for action figures that was happening at that time, but a lot of people still remember it fondly.
Okay. All right.
You might remember the catchphrase Power Extreme.
Yeah, I still don't remember it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, I thought it was a pretty great line, and okay. I hope it gets in the Hall of Fame sometime, and have a great show.
All right, Mark, take care. Yeah, I don't. There's toys. I was 21 in '86, so.
Well, you weren't getting your power.
I was not playing with Centurions when I turned 21. Mm-hmm. So as I, you know, I mean, but as far as like late '60s and into the '70s, I remember a lot of toys and games. There used to be Ants in Your Pants was a game where you would have this big pair of pants with suspenders, and you would shoot these ants. And aim them to go into the pants.
Oh yeah, like the kind of like a board game almost.
Yeah.
Like
it was like a toy / board game. There was a company, I can't remember the name of the company, but they produced that. They produced stuff like Don't Break the Ice, where you had a little hammer and you would tap a piece of ice out of the board, and if you tapped it and it all fell through, you'd lose.
Yeah, they brought those back around when I was a kid in terms of they brought, and I think you could still get Ants in Your Pants.
Oh yeah, no. I think I can't remember the name of the company that released these games, but they were really popular when I was a kid. But it was, I can't remember the name of it. There was like an insect too that was like a bug, like an ant or something that I think was named after. I can't remember now. But like Ants in Your Pants, Don't Break the Ice, those were all from the same game company. And they were huge. Everybody, when I was a kid, everybody had them.
Yeah, I think right now they got bought out by like Hasbro, Milton Bradley, the really like conglomerate names. That's who's got it now.
There was SST cars. Those were big. Let's see. We got some more people on the line. Here's Jeff on WGN. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, I got one for you.
Yeah.
Do you remember the Super Balls?
Oh, of course. Yeah, Super Balls. Oh. They were very, very popular. They're also very popular in vending machines. I remember you can put a quarter into a vending machine and get a Super Ball and then bounce it all over the jewel.
The ones that were the size of a baseball.
Yeah.
It's like you hit one of those things with a bat and they're like, fail like 500 feet.
Yeah. No, those are crazy, the Super Balls, yeah.
But I don't know if you guys will remember, this is maybe in the late 60s. There used to be a show, it was called Band from Uncle.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, they had an anti-shake case. And it had like three different kind of guns in it. Had a button, it opened up, it shot little plastic bullets out. It had all kinds of that kind of weird stuff in there.
Yeah, the Man from Uncle, the tie-in for the Man, we talked about a little bit about that a little earlier. The Man from Uncle was a really popular show for those people who don't remember in the late 60s. And I'm not talking about the Guy Ritchie movie that they made a few years ago, but this was a really popular show. And they did have some tie-ins. They had some toy tie-ins, despite the fact that Man from Uncle really wasn't a kid show. You know, I always find it really amusing, you know, when they take stuff that was originally meant for adults and then they just kind of like change it or aim it towards young people. You know, like I love the fact that RoboCop became a Saturday morning cartoon. RoboCop, which if you go back and watch the original RoboCop from 1987, is one of the most unbelievably violent movies ever made. And so it's crazy to know that like turned into a Saturday morning cartoon, and then there were RoboCop toys.
You know? I had a RoboCop action figure.
See, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Did you see the movie when you were a kid?
No. I was like, no way you're watching.
No,
this.
No
but
way.
Here's the toy. You can play with the RoboCop.
Yeah. And the, you know, same thing happened with Rambo. Rambo became a Saturday morning cartoon. There were Rambo toys and stuff.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I guess I could see the toys, but...
No, it was a Saturday morning cartoon.
Yeah, nothing says fun for the kids like Rambo First Blood Part
yeah.
2, man.
Yeah.
Back to NAM.
So it was... No. It was... I always find it really amusing. Yeah, I grew up playing... Hey, by the way, you ever look at the... You ever go to a web... Do you ever go online and look at the foreign knockoffs of items?
Particularly
the Japanese knockoffs. My favorite knockoff of all time is a RoboCop action figure knockoff, and it's called Robert Cop. I'm not kidding. You should look it up.
Robert Cop.
No, you type in knockoff. It's a Japanese knockoff of RoboCop, and it's called Robert Cop. And it's the funniest thing. You know, those knockoffs are hilarious. I could look at those. Those things are. Did you see it?
Robert Cop 2. I'll be back. Futuristic Robert.
That's, yeah. Those knockoff items, those Japanese knockoff items are absolutely hilarious. I mean, you could go down a big rabbit hole in the internet and find so many hilarious things.
The tagline is, the furniture of law enforcement.
Yeah, that's another thing we should probably do that pretty soon on the show.
Oh, yeah.
Is just talk about knockoffs. Let's do that. Let's plan to do that at some point this week. Because they're unbelievably funny, Robert Cop. So, yeah, I couldn't get you a RoboCop action figure, but I got you a Robert Cop.
Happy birthmas.
Yeah. All right. The news is coming up right after this. I get the same old dreams, same time. Okay. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Skyline studio here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning, 1 to 5 a.m. And Steve Grzanich follows with the opening bell at 5, and then Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back. So they've announced the finalists for the Toy Hall of Fame for 2019 to be inducted. For consideration to be inducted into the Toy Hall of Fame. And we've been talking about toys and stuff like that. Somebody reminds me now of what we were talking about earlier. There were these games that were kind of connected. There was Don't Break the Ice. There was Ants in Your Pants. But the first one that kind of did that when I was trying to think of that bug was Cootie. 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 And I used to love that game, and that was like very similar to those other games that I was talking about. I think they were all from the same company. Now they're all run by Hasbro. Has them now.
And I was going to ask. We had Mark from Cleveland called back in and said, "Was it Shaper Toys or perhaps Tyco Toys?
Could have been Tyco, maybe.
Could have been Tyco.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but they were all. I believe they were all from the same." Company, all of those games. There was more too. There was Don't Break the Ice. It was Ants in Your Pants, and Cootie was the original. 815 area code remembers this, and sent in a text. And if you want to jump in, call or text us at 312-981-7200. 815 area code says the bug that you put together was called Cootie, COOTIE. Each part was numbered, and you rolled a die to see which part you got. Whoever finished the bug first was the winner. So you're basically building a bug. It was this plastic bug. And whoever, you know, built the bug first was the winner. And Ants in Your Pants was always a lot of fun because you would shoot the ants from across the room and try to get them into a pair of pants. Big plastic pair of pants with suspenders sticking up.
shooting threes from way outside.
You know, I always, when we start talking about toys and games and card games and stuff, the card game that I grew up playing that I love the most, that was my favorite, was a game called Authors. It was one of my favorite games of all time, and I learned, I would not have known, you know, the name of four novels that Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote had I not played Authors at a very young age. The original Authors was a pairing game. You wanted to get all four books. Each card had an author's face and name on it, and then the name of a book. And you would want to collect all four of the different books that author wrote, and you would have a complete set. And the idea was to have as many sets of books by each author as possible, and then you'd be the winner. But I'm not kidding when I say that it's a fun game. It's a fun card game. But it was also very educational. Like, I really did learn. I learned a lot about who wrote what book when I was a kid. And I'm trying to remember who all the, you know, who all the people were, who all the authors were part of the original Authors card game that I had. And I know Robert Louis Stevenson, Louisa May Alcott, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Edgar Allan Poe, Tom Sawyer. The author of Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. Mark Twain was in there, and the original Authors game, the original card game. Those were there were more too. There were more authors, and I can't remember who they all were.
But so I do have the list here.
Okay,
so it's Louisa May Alcott, right. James Fenimore Cooper,
right,
Chuck Dickens, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Washington Irving, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Sir Walter Scott, Bill Shakespeare, Robert Louis Stevenson, Alfred, Lord Tennyson, and Mark Twain.
Yeah, that was it. Those are the original ones. And who's going to know Alfred, Lord Tennyson at the age of seven? But because of that game, I could name four books that he wrote when I was like 7 or 8 years old. And it was a fun game. Authors was a really, really fun game. But truly, I learned from playing that game. I did. I thought it was cool. Had you ever heard of Authors before?
No, but it made me want to. I'm probably going to purchase it. I think it's like $7 on Amazon.
Yeah.
And it's hours of fun.
Now, there are different versions of Authors because, like, other companies put it out and they put different writers. But the original one has very distinctive artwork, beautiful color artwork, with the portraits of each artist, each writer. It's a terrific game. I've mentioned it before on the air, and I know that there are people out there who have played it. So, you know, we've over the years, I used to get mocked by Esmeralda and Dan over my love for Authors.
That's exactly the kind of game I would have loved playing growing up.
Oh, I loved it, man. I absolutely loved it. And I mean, we used to play it all the time. All the time. And then, I'm not kidding, you know, when we started reading, you know how you have to have your, when they assign you to read books in school.
Right.
I knew which books were what, you know, some of the books that we were on that were on the list of books that we were probably going to have to read or whatever. I was like, oh, I know that book. I know who wrote that. I know who wrote that. All because I played this card game. It's a great game. I'm glad it's still out there. Here's Chris on WGN. Hi, Chris.
Hey, good foggy morning, Nick. Four games I remember vividly. Kerplunk, hands down. Battling Tops and Stratego.
Stratego.
And Stratego, I remember, you could never figure out or remember which beat which piece.
Right.
We always had to look at the instructions.
Yeah. The Kerplunk is another one. I got two texts on that. People loved Kerplunk. I remember Kerplunk. I loved Stratego when I was a kid. I loved Stratego. I used to play that all the time. In the Battle Tops, as he's talking about, that's a classic one. Chris, thanks for the call. And, of course, Battleship. Nobody's mentioned Battleship. Classic game. And then there was Electronic Battleship. I never liked Electronic Battleship. I preferred regular Battleship. Yeah. Yeah, so another Kerplunk. 847 area code saying Kerplunk. I'm trying to remember, what was the object of Kerplunk? I remember the name. Wait a minute. Maybe I can find out here, because I remember I know I had it and I know we used to play it. All right, let me see. All right, Kerplunk. Oh, I see what it was. There were a bunch of marbles would be on top. You would have the marbles, and there were a bunch of sticks that were stuck inside the this tube, and you would slowly pull one stick out at a time, and you didn't want the marbles to fall. That was the idea. Those thin sticks that were stuck inside the tube were holding the marbles up, and as you slowly slid a stick out, you wanted to make sure that the marbles did not fall. That was Kerplunk. good morning, Nick. 219 area code says, how about spinning tops, hopscotch, or hula hoop? Yeah, hopscotch is, I guess that could be inducted.
Okay. Again, if a stick
can.
Anybody can.
Yeah. Hula hoop. Canadian Bill says, I knew a guy who would use his glass eye for marbles, not necessarily a game of keepsies. Where did the glass eye stuff start here? Does everybody know somebody with a glass eye? Because I told the story about my friend Paul from high school who had a glass eye. Used to stick it in people's soup and stuff. He used to just take it out and stick it in people's soup or in their food.
So gross.
And he would have to take it out when he was playing sports because he played football. You have to have the, because if you get, hit, the eye could go jammed up into his skull or something. But yeah, I knew a guy with a glass eye in high school. That's a lot of fun when you're 15 years old, you got a glass eye. How are you not going to stick it in people's cereal? How is that? How are you 15? I just think it's crazy that there's another Canadian Bill knew somebody with a glass eye that would mess around with it, like use it as a marble.
That'd be a terrifying game of marbles. All of a sudden you just
It's a pretty big marble, though. Or marbles. Yeah, they have marbles that size.
Yeah, get pretty big.
That are eyeball sized, sure. 847 area code says, I want to make a push for the Sears Christmas wish book to be a toy. Used to spend hours looking at it and would fight with my brother and two sisters to read it. That was a big deal, man. The Christmas wish book from Sears, that was a big deal. Sears catalogs were a big deal. And then you're a kid and you look at the ladies' underwear section of the Sears bra, wish book. That was risque, man. Looking at the ladies in their underwear in the Sears catalog.
Ooh la la.
Hey, that was fun back in the 70s, man. That's how you had fun. Jay says, hey, Nick, hi. My cousin Karen played with Barbie and Barbie's younger sister, Skipper. Skipper?
She had a younger sister?
I didn't know that. Hmm. Named Skipper? It's a weird name. Barbie and Skipper?
She's really into boats.
Wait a second. I think Mary, did you have a Skipper?
Oh, absolutely.
No, so that was her. How do I not know that that's Barbie's sister?
I thought it was Barbie's cousin.
Oh, Barbie's cousin. Okay.
But I'm not sure. But, oh, I had... Skipper had short little bangs.
Uh-huh.
And she was a teenager. So she had little bangs and long blonde hair.
Oh, that's Skipper.
Yeah.
What were your favorite toys growing up, Mare?
Oh, man. Spinning tops?
Yeah, we were just talking about that.
Oh, we were?
Yeah.
Okay. I had the Slinky, of course. Mm-hmm. I had my baby doll. My Madame Alexander baby doll, which I still have.
Wow.
Bridget.
Wow.
Yes. I terrorize my son-in-law with Bridget. He hates dolls, and I put Bridget in various places in the house.
Oh, that's scary. That's pretty cool, because a lot of people are freaked out by dolls.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
But, yeah, I mean, my brothers used to terrorize me with everything weaponry.
Yeah.
The jarts, the BB guns. My brother once shot out a bunch of Christmas ornaments with his new BB gun. My mother was not happy at all.
See, now, Mary, you and I are around the same age.
Yes.
And, I was telling Tom some of the adventures we had. It's amazing we're still alive.
Oh, I can't believe it.
Yeah. I mean, the kind of toys that we had and the way we played with them, it's insane.
Oh, yeah. And every single one of them, the Easy Bake Oven.
Oh, sure.
Burned myself every day with that thing.
Yeah.
And that horrible food. Oh.
Yeah, yeah. And you would feed all your friends.
Oh, yeah, and I thought those little cakes were just delicious.
Yeah. Oh,
my brother would eat them, and he was like...
Well, that's great. Okay, thank you for confirming Skipper.
Sure, but yeah, there's Skipper. Midge was a cousin as well.
Midge.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
She was not attractive, but we had Midge.
Okay, there you go. All right. Thanks, Mayor. Mary Vandeveld is in traffic this morning, and she'll be starting with the opening bell. Let's take a break here for the weather, and then my dad is going to tell a joke, and we have a Blackhawks Express to play back from the exhibition game.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Yeah, that's right. Every Monday morning, my dad calls in and tells a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We like to start off your work week with a laugh, so my dad is going to tell a joke. Coming up, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, let's get to it. Here's my dad. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Nick.
How are you, buddy?
I'm doing good.
Good. How's Ma?
Good.
All right.
Doing good.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, coming in, don't break the ice, you also don't spill the beans.
Oh, don't spill the beans. That's right. That was from the same.
And you had a lot of Johnny Lightning cars.
I had Johnny Lightning cars, and I had the Hot and the Hot Wheels and all that stuff.
The garage and all that. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, man, I had a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
All right, you got a joke.
Okay, I'm ready.
All right.
Got it.
Go.
I said, I didn't think orthopedic shoes would help me, but I stand corrected.
Dad, Tom is giving you a standing ovation for that one. Stood up and applauded, laughing his butt off. Stood up and applauded. Stand corrected. All right, Dad. Thanks, buddy.
Take care. Bye.
He'll do it again next week.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
Standing O. Tom, standing O.
That was great. That was... It's the simplicity of it is really what got me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There it is. All right, my dad, he's been telling jokes his whole life. By the way, you know, as you probably know if you're a regular listener, my dad works at Jewel. He works at the Jewel at Irving and Narragansett, and people choose to go into the line where my dad is bagging so my dad can tell them jokes. He's more popular there than anybody. It's crazy. It's crazy. And he loves working there. My dad's 78, and he still, you know, he works 4 days a week at Jewel. My dad has never not had, at least two jobs. And he still works from home doing some vending sales.
Yeah. Hardest working man.
He's amazing. And he's also funny. So, all right. Every time the Hawks play, the day after... we have a Blackhawks Express. They had a fun game in Berlin. It was an exhibition game. And every single time there's a game the night before we go on the air, we always play the Blackhawks Express, which is a great thing that the sports department puts together after every game where they give you all the highlights in one great little package. And so here is the Blackhawks Express from yesterday.
Out the preseason tonight here in Deutschland and step into history as they take on the class of the German Elite League, the Berlin Ice Barret, in a game that will feature a unique contrast in styles, wide open hockey, and a big rink. Underway here in Berlin, the Ice Barret control. Gilbert now from the deep slot area, put it down to Kane, now behind the net to Taves, beside the net, he shoots and scores! Jonathan Taves with a shot from around the bottom of the right wing circle, over the left shoulder of Dom, and into the top shelf, with 52 seconds remaining in period number one, it's 1-0 Hawks. Kane along the right force to Taves, top of the right circle of the line, Gustas send it to Brinkin, top of the left circle. Backing up, he'll flip it to Kane, top of the right. To Gustafson at the line, deep slot, back to Kane, over to Nabrinkit, left circle, shoots! Oh, what a save by Dom! He got across and got the stick inside the net and knocked that one away. Save of the game. To Hurdler, losing in over the Hawk line along the right wing side. Duncan Keith lifts the stick, took the puck away, but there's a flash in front, shot, they score! Sean Backman standing all alone in front of Robin Leonard. Takes a pass that originated from behind the Hawk net and fired it past Robin Leonard. We're tied at one. in the corner. Lost it up the boards. Mata pinches, knocks it down in behind the Berlin net. Right corner to Kane. Put it to the doorstep. There's a shot by Nylander. He scores! Alexander Nylander standing beside the left post. Caught an errant puck. Kicked it to a stick and put it into the roof. And the Hawks retake the lead at 2-1. LaPierre got the puck behind the net, put it over to the right wing boards for Reichel. There goes the goaltender, Frantrap. Oh, and he shouldn't have left the net. David Kemp with a loose puck, fires it down toward the empty net. He scores! An empty net goal for David Kemp. Terrible timing on the part of Frantrap. We have 7 seconds left in the game. Ice Baron gets the puck. Erler will clear it out to center ice. Strome got it with 2 seconds. One, and this one is in the books. So an exhibition game between the Blackhawks and the Berlin Ice Baron ends with the Blackhawks winning 3-1.
All right. There you go. Yeah. And so the actual season kicks off for real on Friday in Prague. And we will have it here on WGN. And speaking of the NHL starting again, I want to mention that on Wednesday morning, Rick Geezer is going to be with us. He has sports songs, and those are songs that are performed by athletes and people involved in professional sports or college sports or anything like that. And he always comes in whenever a new season of sports starts. So hockey's getting its start this week. So we'll have a specific hockey version of sports songs to have some fun with Rick Geezer, and that's coming up Wednesday morning. All right, we are talking about toys. Jay also says, in addition to Barbie's friend Skipper, Combat Joe is what he would play with. Is that different than G.I. Joe? Is that like the knockoff of G.I.? Is that like the Robert Cop of G.I. Joe? Battleship. Everybody mentions Battleship. And trading baseball cards. He used to love to trade baseball cards. 312 area code says, speaking of injuries, we used to make a ramp out of a sheet of plywood and some cinder blocks and use it as a bicycle ramp, probably influenced by Evel Knievel. There was always one person that lacked coordination and would go airborne off of the ramp and then land on a bad wobble and go crashing into the steel garbage cans and get all scraped up. Yeah, that sounds about right. Hey, you know that Jess from the Gilmore Girls?
Mm-hmm.
Milo Ventimiglia.
Ventimiglia.
Yeah, he's playing Evel Knievel in a movie.
I'm okay with that.
This is the third time they've made a movie about Evel Knievel.
Which one is I don't think I've ever seen.
The other two were in the 70s, back when Evel Knievel. I mean, Evel Knievel was huge when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So he played himself in one movie. Evel Knievel played himself in another movie. And then the other person who played Evel Knievel in the back in the 70s was George Hamilton.
What?
Yeah. George Hamilton played Evel Knievel.
Not bad. Not bad.
But, seriously, a lot of people, if you weren't around back then, you have no idea how big Evel Knievel was. People loved him. Broke every bone in his body and was very proud of that. You
jumped
know,
all those buses or whatever.
Not just buses, but he the Grand Canyon at one point, he was going to jump.
Whew, he thought he was going to jump the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So, Evel Knievel, man. So, look forward to it. Milo Ventimiglia is going to be in it. And I don't think he gets killed by a crock pot in this movie, so, like he does on This Is Us.
Wait, that's what gets him?
Yeah, crockpot.
Oh, that's too bad.
All right, we got a break here. The news is coming up after this. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will be back tomorrow with Tom Appel. And if you have any concerns or questions about cars or automotive-related stuff, you can join us, and we'll talk to him, and he'll help you out. We're also probably going to do some knockoff stuff tomorrow since we had some fun with that this morning.